business time, baby.
You are listening to Solo Monster Sounds Off.
It's such good shit.
Mama Monster.
Conquered! I'm home!
You like fighting a woman?
You're saying Vince McMahon is stupid. Is that what you're saying?
Oh my God, we're only an hour in. We have two more hours of this.
God, this dialogue is shit.
Who writes this stuff? Bruce?
Come over here and threaten me.
I'm the Solo Monster, damn it.
Solo Monster? Who are you to doubt El Dandy?
Woo!
This is episode 709 of the Solo Monster Sounds Off for Sunday, June 20th, 2021. I am the Solo Monster. Happy Father's Day to all of the dads out there, including Roman Reigns, who, in recognizing the importance of family and his role as the head of the table, one must be at the table. He made sure to get his business done early on Friday so that he could be home for Father's Day. What a babyface move. And if Roman is an Amazon Prime member and he hears this, I'm sure he can afford it, but if he signs up for a trial of Amazon Music with our link, he would get 4 months free. And so would you. You don't have to be the tribal chief. But only if you sign up between now and Tuesday, June 22nd. It's only a couple of days away, so time is running out. 4 months of Amazon Music for free. Will you use our link to sign up? GetAmazonMusic.com/Solomonster. Even if you're not a Prime member, you can still try it out free for 3 months. Free for three. But you know you want those extra 30 days. You know you want that extra month. GetAmazonMusic.com/Solomonster. If you want to make a PayPal donation, you may do so, as these fine folks did this week. $10 or more will get you a nickname and a shout-out. Just head on over to thesolomonster.com. That little button you see parked on the right side of your page, that little guy's been there for, God, probably, what, almost a decade now he's been sitting there? He never moves. He's always in the same spot, at least until I redesign things and get a new website up, so head on over there if you'd like to do so. I want to say thank you this week to the Portland pop star, Paul Hamilton. Paul, you are a beast. Thank you. Night Stalker, Nayef Al-Safar, Big Bear, Brian Becerra, Beast Mode, Brock Joseph, the Chicago Slayer, Willie Eichard, Billy Hardcore Habibi, the Diamond Dallas Dance Machine, Harrison Soep, Velvet Revolver, Robert Murray, the Wichita Workhorse, Clayton Nettleton, Ostentatious, Alan Carter, the Alabama Assassin, Chris Young, New York Punk, Arnold Modesto, Sherrod, Big Daddy Boyd. Want to say happy birthday to Will Lionheart Rawlings, who turns 29 years old today. He and his tag team partner, Brian the Stinger Timeyer, they make up the Cincinnati Bromans. And Brian let me know that today was your birthday, so I hope it's a good one. And I want to say happy birthday and send a very special birthday shout-out to Alex the Mayor Gleason, who is turning 12 years old. Maybe you can run for mayor here in New York City. You'd be better than any of the choices I've seen so far. But Alex, I hope it's a great birthday. I hear you're a fan of the podcast. I want to thank you for listening, and I hope you get a very nice gift. Not that I'm putting any pressure on anyone to buy you a really nice gift, but I hope you get what you want here for your birthday. And a very special Father's Day shout out to Raymond the Mountie Medina, who is not only celebrating his 37th birthday today, but he is also celebrating the birth of his first and only son, Noah, who was born this past Tuesday. And not only that, today is Father's Day, right? All of this is happening at the same time, and things just seem to be in a very special place for he and his family. And I want to say congratulations, first of all, on baby Noah. And happy birthday. This is going to be a very happy birthday, I'm sure, for Raymond. His first Father's Day as a dad. And it also happens to be his birthday. So, Raymond, thank you for all the support. And again, congratulations. I am very happy for you. The official Sound Off Discord server is up and running. I mentioned this last week. It is exclusive right now to our YouTube channel members only. So it is one of the perks that you get for your YouTube membership, regardless of which tier. There's two different tiers. Regardless of which one, you will have access to that Discord server. I have to approve you first. So again, let me know what your YouTube name is, what your Discord handle is, and we'll get you set up in the server. But you can find the post on the YouTube channel under the community tab. And again, just leave that information and we'll get you on in there. That plus the Sound Off Legends get access to the lost episodes, the early episodes of the Sound Off. And there's always new ones going up every week, or I'm trying to every week anyway. So I appreciate everybody who has joined. One other note, there is a brand new episode, episode 35 of RSPW Rewind. It's been a while since I got one of these up. We got a brand new one up, over 30 minutes long, that went up the other day. YouTube members got it first for the first 24 hours, and now it is open to everyone, and it is getting great feedback. So please head on over to the channel to take a gander at that. Hit the like button, leave a comment while you are there. I am going to have a lot to say about the China documentary that aired on Vice this week. I'm going to save that for later, probably right before I do the history section. And it's a big one. We got a big history segment this week, bigger than it's been the last couple of weeks. And I'm going to get into Hell in a Cell predictions here in a second. But first, I just want to send best wishes to Don West, who announced this week that he is starting treatment for brain lymphoma that he was recently diagnosed with. That was awful news to read, but his friends say that he is in good spirits. Of course he is. He's always in good spirits. I don't think I've ever seen the guy without a smile on his face. Don is underrated as an announcer. He was not great when he first started out. He would just scream and shout, and you can appreciate his you know, level of enthusiasm, but he just wasn't a very good announcer. You know, he had no experience doing it before that. He was a pitch man. That's really what he was. He would go on television and he would pitch baseball cards and other sports memorabilia, and he was very, very good at doing that. He was very effective at that. Of course, the classic video, which I kind of hope is still up on YouTube, because I always used to get a kick out of watching it, where he was up one night on the Shop at Home Network hawking some baseball cards, and he had them all like stacked up like a house of cards, and then the whole thing just fell apart. But he didn't let it stop him. There he was, down on his hands and knees on the floor, live on television, with all these cards just strewn about on the floor, and he's still selling. He's going through it like it's a swimming pool of cards. He didn't let it stop him. But that's the world that he came from. Over time, though, while he was in TNA, he grew into the role very nicely. And that passion and that enthusiasm that he had, that's one of the things missing from wrestling commentary today, because it is so homogenized that you rarely are able to get. I mean, you got that with Mauro Ranallo. You can find little instances with certain people where you might get that, but it's just very, I think homogenized is a good word. Sanitized maybe is a better word for it. That level of enthusiasm that you used to hear in Jim Ross's voice, you know, 25 years ago when he would go nuts, or you know, Triple H, the dastardly heel, would do something and he would just, you would think that Triple H, you know, kidnapped his own children. You don't really find that today. But I got to see him do his thing at one of the TNA shows. They did at the minor league baseball stadiums. He was outside the stadium promoting his brown bag special that he used to sell. Fans were out there waiting in line, and he's just standing there on the sidewalk, and he's promoting, he's pitching. And he barely paused to take a breath. He was so red in the face, I thought he was going to keel over and have a heart attack. But he sold a lot of brown bags that day. And he couldn't have been a nicer guy. Any type of brain cancer especially, serious stuff. And I hope he can pull through. That was very shitty news to hear this week when I saw that. WWE Hell in a Cell is tonight from the Thunderdome, the final Thunderdome pay-per-view. The Thunderdome has served its purpose, but the time has come to move on. and get back to wrestling the way it was meant to be, in front of a bunch of smarks just chanting things to get themselves over. Wrestle Rumble is getting in on the Hell in a Cell action tonight with the Hell in a Cell Pick'em Contest. Top prize, $1,000 cash. The deadline is tonight at 8 p.m. Eastern when the pay-per-view begins. Contestants earn points by correctly answering prop questions, and the winners will be announced tomorrow. At Wrestle Rumble is their handle on Twitter, as well as on Instagram, and all entrants will receive an email as well. Some of the prop questions that you will have to answer. How will Charlotte versus Rhea Ripley end? It's going to end by pinfall or submission. Will any wrestlers end up on top of the Hell in a Cell? Will any of the Usos and Dominic Mysterio enter the cage during the Reigns-Mysterio match? Well, I guess that's not a prop question anymore, since they already did the fucking match on television the other night. I'm going to incorporate my thoughts on that into my Hell in a Cell preview here in a second. Will any tables break during some of the matches? That gives you a sense of the types of questions that you will have to answer to accrue points. It's a lot of fun. And all you got to do is go to WrestleRumble.com to enter. And for whatever you pay for your entry, you can end up with $1,000 cash. That's a hell of a return on your investment. You still have plenty of time to enter, so head on over to WrestleRumble.com. And tonight, on my Hell in a Cell review after the pay-per-view, I am going to have a very exciting announcement. And it concerns Wrestle Rumble. You are not going to want to miss this, I promise you. So make sure you are tuned into the stream later tonight. I am going to go through each match and give my predictions. Sheamus is still not cleared from his broken nose, or else we would be getting a triple threat match on this show for the U.S. title with him defending against Ricochet and Humberto Carrillo. That match is going to happen, not tonight, but it is going to happen eventually. And when it happens and Sheamus wins, I think the next person to step up to his open challenge and take the title will be Damian Priest. So you can keep that in the back of your mind. It may not happen until SummerSlam, but I do believe Priest will be your next United States champion. Alexa Bliss takes on the Queen of Spades, Shayna Baszler, or as the match preview on WWE.com calls her, the Queen of Spaces. I don't know if that means parking spaces. I can picture Baszler in her next gimmick as an angry meter maid now. I don't know what spaces they're referring to. Maybe the space in between their fucking ears, where there should be a brain. But on Raw Monday night, Alexa said that in light of her doll, Lily, acting naughty, and in light of WWE returning to the road soon, she has decided to put Lily in time out. Which, translated, means they realize that this doll shit isn't going to fly in front of live audiences, which is exactly what I said last week. So at least they had enough common sense to put the doll to bed for the time being. That's the good news. Lily is in timeout. For how long, we don't know. But that's the good news. The bad news is that we've gone from dolls to hypnosis. And no, I am not talking about the wrestling legend that Bret Hart said he wanted to wrestle in WCW. Bliss had a match with Nia Jax that she had won when Reginald interfered. Bliss then stared into the eyes of Reggie. He stared back. He seemed to be in some sort of trance before Nia chased her away. Now, we still could see the stupid doll tonight make an appearance. The only way Alexa Bliss, I think, does not win this match, and obviously she's my pick to win, the only reason Alexa would, I think, lose is if Bray Wyatt reappears and costs her the win the way that she did to him at WrestleMania in his match against Randy Orton. Short of that, Bliss is winning this match. Seth Rollins takes on Cesaro. Cesaro has two wins over Rollins, one at WrestleMania, and another on TV before he earned his Universal title match against Roman Reigns. There will not be a third. Cesaro had his match. That's all I ever wanted. Just give the guy a shot. Give the guy a title match on pay-per-view. Let him go out there and show what he can do in a big main event. And he did. And they had an excellent match. But now that's over. And we know that this is where Seth Rollins is very likely going to get his win. And Cesaro settles back into the middle of the card. If it goes any other way, I will be pleasantly surprised. I do not see that happening. Rollins is my pick to win, and it's SummerSlam, and you know this if you listened to the podcast last week when I ran down what I think the top of the SummerSlam card is going to look like. I think it's SummerSlam. It's Seth Rollins one-on-one against Edge at Allegiant Stadium. And wouldn't you know, now we're seeing reports that when Edge comes back, he's going to be a babyface. Exactly what I said last week. Just because Edge was acting heelish the last time we saw him doesn't mean that when he comes back, he's going to be a heel. He and Rollins is a match we've never seen before. It would be a big match for Seth on that show. I think that's the way they're going with this. Rhea Ripley defends the Raw Women's title against Charlotte Flair. To say the build to this match has been underwhelming would be an understatement. The Raw and SmackDown women's divisions right now are as weak as they have been in many years, and that is with two champions that I like. I was happy to see both of them win the title at WrestleMania. It's not their fault. I don't blame them. But something has to be done soon. Hopefully with this draft that's coming up after SummerSlam, things will be shaken up a little bit. We'll get some new faces distributed evenly amongst Raw and SmackDown, because it's not just one over the other. I mean, the SmackDown women's division is just a fucking mess right now. But they're both a mess. So they both need help. And hopefully that help is evenly divided among the two brands. Nikki Cross has racked up cheap wins over both the champion and the challenger in beat-the-clock matches. And on Monday, she beat Charlotte by countout. Rhea had a match with Asuka that at least she won. And then Charlotte attacked. And the two of them had a pull-apart brawl that was better than anything they've done with these two in a month. The worst thing they could do is just put the belt back on Charlotte when Rhea is still finding her footing as champion. She's gotten a gazillion wins over Asuka, has Rhea. There's no reason that she should not avenge her WrestleMania loss to Charlotte from last year. But we know that title is going to make its way back around the waist of the Queen. We know it's coming. The only question is, do they do the title change tonight, or do they wait until SummerSlam? I say it happens here. I don't think they can help themselves. I believe Charlotte Flair will be the new... God, how many titles would that be for? I was going to spit out a number and I just realized I don't even know what the number is. How many titles would this be if she wins tonight? I've lost count. 11? 12? Are we counting NXT titles? Because she has two of those. That would drive the number up even higher. I don't know. Whatever the number is, she is going to pass her father's record by next year. Bianca Belair defends the SmackDown Women's Championship against Bayley. This will now be contested inside Hell in a Cell, only because they decided to move the Universal title match to television. Bianca issued the challenge on Friday. Bayley came out, no smile. Bayley looked serious. She got in the ring. They brawled, and Bayley left her laying with the rose plant and held the title up high. There were no jokes. There was no laughing from Bayley on TV this week. But this feud does not warrant a cell match. You know what does warrant Hell in a Cell when I look at this card? Kevin Owens and Sami Zayn. They just got added to the show on Friday. That is a rivalry worthy of Hell in a Cell. Way more than this match. Even with the Cell, I think they're going to have to do a third match between these two next month. Because they don't have anybody else ready right now. Unless they just throw Carmella in a random match next month against Bianca. They have to save Sasha and Bianca for SummerSlam. You're not going to do that next month of Money in the Bank. So even though this is in the Cell, I'm not so sure this is going to be the end. I think they have to do one more after this. But I'm picking Bianca to retain. And when Becky Lynch comes back, and she is, she was spotted training at the Performance Center this week. As I pitched last week, you can do Becky one-on-one against Bayley at SummerSlam. Non-title, just a straight-up singles match. Now, I mentioned Kevin Owens against Sami Zayn. That was just added. Zayn briefly distracted Owens during his match. It was Owens and Big E on Friday against Apollo Crews and Commander Aziz making his in-ring debut. And Owens got caught with the Nigerian nail. He was pinned. Kevin Owens will win this match. And we have seen this match so many times before that doing it inside Hell in a Cell would have at least added a different dimension to it. It is a feud worthy of a payoff inside the cell. When I look at these different feuds on television, these two guys have been feuding forever. I mean, that's the whole gimmick. We'll be doing this forever. They said that back in Ring of Honor, and here we are all these years later in WWE. If anything on this card was worthy of a cell match, I think it's Kevin Owens against Sami Zayn. I think it's a mistake not to do that. Drew McIntyre challenges Bobby Lashley for the WWE title inside Hell in a Cell, and if McIntyre loses, he can never again challenge for the championship so long as Lashley is the champion. McIntyre pinned Lashley in the six-man tag to end Raw on Monday. It was McIntyre and the Viking Raiders against Lashley, AJ Styles, and Omos. Drew already lost one Hell in a Cell match, the first one I think he was ever in, against Randy Orton. He lost at WrestleMania, clean. He failed to win the title at Backlash. And if he loses again, he cannot challenge for the championship again until Lashley drops it to someone else. All signs here point to a Drew McIntyre victory. But I'm going to go a different way. I'm going to go a different way and predict that Lashley retains when Jinder Mahal and the new crew, I guess, that he showed up with that one week on Raw before they vanished. Maybe the reason they vanished is because they've been saving them for this spot. Jinder costs McIntyre, his former 3MB brother, his last chance, for now, to reclaim the title. And Drew then goes off to feud with Jinder for the summer, and Lashley gets a couple more months with the gold. I mean, there isn't any other obvious opponent right now for McIntyre. Believe me, McIntyre against Mahal would not be my first, second, or third choice. I'm not trying to will it into existence, but they have a history they can draw on. I would keep the title on Lashley a little bit longer, try to get that Brock Lesnar match with the belt on the line, even though the title doesn't have to be on the line, but it should be, because, I mean, otherwise, why would Brock Lesnar, I mean, think about this in a kayfabe sense. Why would Brock Lesnar come back, if not to go after the championship? Right? What is it that motivates him? Money. Titles. Titles equals money. He never cared about Lashley before. Lashley came back to the company in 2018. He didn't care about him before and they were on the same roster. So why would he care to fight him now? Why would he come out of his semi-retirement now if not to get back the championship that he lost? But, if they cannot get Brock for SummerSlam, if Lesnar is not coming back, there is another possibility. One of the few things that has actually kept my attention and intrigued me about Monday Night Raw in recent weeks has been the backstage segments with MVP and Kofi Kingston. On Monday, we had more of it. MVP pointed out that New Day had lost their match against Orton and Riddle, but it was Xavier Woods who was pinned and not Kofi. And MVP told him, the reason you haven't been back in the WWE title hunt since you lost the belt is because you've been toiling away in tag team stuff. And he ended with, good luck Sunday at Hell in a Cell, before he realized what he said, and he pointed at, oh, that's right, Kofi, you don't have a match at Hell in a Cell. This is the story that intrigues me the most on that show, and I could see Kofi winning Money in the Bank next month and cashing in for a match against Lashley at SummerSlam. If they can't get a really big name to put him in the ring with, they can go with the Kofi story. And he, you know, announces in advance that he's going to cash in. He tries to prove MVP wrong. So that's another way they can go with it. I was thinking about that the other day. So I may be going against the odds on this one, especially now that they're probably ending the show with this. This is now the de facto main event without Roman Reigns being on the show. And if they want to go off the air on a happy note and, you know, with Drew all out of chances, there is a very good chance that he will win. But I'm going to stick with Lashley as my prediction. Now, late in the week, WWE announced that Rey Mysterio did not want to wait for Sunday. He wanted Roman Reigns inside Hell in a Cell on Fox Friday night, so they took their main event off the pay-per-view. Because remember, Roman, he doesn't go on second to last. He either goes on first or he goes on last. And they took their main event off the pay-per-view, which is the only reason Lashley now and McIntyre can go on last. And they put it on free television in the main event instead to try to pop a big rating, which didn't really work. The show may have been up slightly, but it should have been up a lot more than it was with Roman Reigns defending the title in a cell match on TV. Taking that match off of this show did nothing but weaken this pay-per-view. I thought the match was pretty standard fare. I mean, outside of Roman powerbombing Rey out of the ring into the side of the cage, which, you know, was a cool visual, not as cool as him tossing Dominic like a fucking lawn dart. Outside of that one spot, there was no reason for this to be contested inside the cell. I mean, I sound like a broken record. I say this about a lot of these matches, but it's true. There was no reason for this to have to be inside Hell in a Cell. This is what the gimmick has been turned into. It's just been bastardized so much. It's no wonder when Hell in a Cell comes around, what does it really mean? Do you honestly get excited when you realize, oh, it's Hell in a Cell this month? No. I'm willing to bet the vast majority of people listening to this right now, you probably shrug your shoulders and you go back to whatever it was that you were doing. And that's fucking sad, because that's not how Hell in a Cell used to be. Sadly, though, it's been this way for many years. I said this never should have been turned into a gimmick pay-per-view. You want to do a Money in the Bank pay-per-view, fine. But like TLC, Hell in a Cell, these never should have been converted into pay-per-views once a year. Especially this gimmick. This one should have been saved. This one should have been preserved. But I thought this match, it was fine, but it was actually pretty forgettable. You know, Rey did get a lot of offense in, but after the powerbomb spot, Roman brought him back into the ring and locked on the guillotine until Rey tapped out. So after what happened to his son, at least let the guy fight and struggle until he passes out. Instead, they had him tap out almost immediately. And then Jimmy Uso comes into the ring to stand with Roman. He finally acknowledges him. Jimmy Uso was on this show telling Roman that he understands now. He may not always agree with him 100% on everything, but he gets it now. But Roman wanted to know, where's your brother? Where's Jay? And he didn't know. Jay is MIA right now. So Roman retains like we all knew he would. On Talking Smack, Paul Heyman issued an open challenge to anyone who wants to step up to the Tribal Chief on SmackDown this Friday. I think it has to be one of three names. I think the likeliest choice is probably Dominic Mysterio, who last we saw him, he was taking flight. One of the coolest things I've seen in a long time, the way they shot that. If not Dominic, I think it ends up being one of the Usos, probably Jay. Jay returns and he wants to challenge Reigns, and it'd be kind of funny if now it was Jimmy trying to talk him out of going against Roman when it's been the opposite for the last several weeks. But they're going to have to find something to occupy Roman until John Cena makes his grand return, which I'm guessing does not happen until July 16th, when they're back on the road for that first show in front of fans. But I don't expect there to be, you know, an NXT call-up on Friday that's going to answer the challenge or anything like that. I think it ends up being one of those three names. So again, join me tonight. I will be live on YouTube as soon as the pay-per-view goes off the air. We'll recap the entire show. And don't forget, I have a fun announcement to make. You're not going to want to miss it. Andrew Zariot of the Matt Men podcast tweeted this week one concept that he heard about. Some sort of point tournament, this is in WWE, where the competitors get points based on special moves, wins, and stipulations. The winner of the point-based tournament would get some sort of title shot. Let me say that I have no idea if WWE would go for this. This is just something I heard was suggested by one of the networks. TNA did something like this years ago. It was called the Bound for Glory series, and it was a mess to follow. But if they do something, let's say, round robin style, it would basically be WWE's version of the G1. It's kind of what I'm getting out of that, if this were to actually happen. And it sounds like this is a ways off from actually happening if it does. I've gotten that question over the years, should WWE do their own version of the G1, some kind of similar type of tournament? In a perfect world, I would love to see it, but I have no faith that WWE would do it the correct way or would have the patience for something like that. I don't see it working out in this company. I just don't. It's not what they do. They're not really good at stuff like that. They're good at what they do. And even that's debatable. But them having rankings or points and this and that, do I have faith in Vince McMahon and the current writing team to follow through the right way on something like that? Of course not. So while I think the potential for it to be fun is there, in execution, it would probably be a fucking mess. Now, there's more news. WWE officials are said to be looking into doing more themed shows such as Old School Raw, King of the Ring, and Viewer's Choice. And Fightful Select reported this week that Fox and USA / NBC Universal were a big part of the push for more theme shows to happen. There are said to be several additional NBC Sports integrated pitches that are being made. The pitches include tie-ins with NASCAR, contingent around a major race that would integrate race cars and star drivers. Another pitch included NFL Night, for the launch of Sunday Night Football with football-themed matches and angles and NFL players and commentators appearing. I hear that, and I think of old Art Donovan from the 1994 King of the Ring, which it just so happens is covered in depth this week in the history segment a little bit later on in the show this week. So, the last little bit of this is a Wrestling World Cup apparently was also pitched, which would include all of the brands. NBC has made a pitch for what would be a points month, where wins and moves and other things are done to rack up points for wrestlers. So this may tie in with what Andrew Zarian is hearing. You know, I hear this, and on the one hand, I think that themed shows can be fun, right? You want to make the shows fun. So I think you could do theme shows, and it's just something that changes up the monotony of these shows, right? It just changes things up, the look of the show, the feel of the show. You kind of gimmick it up a little bit. If done right, if they make it fun, it could be a lot of fun to follow. So I'm not against the idea of them doing themes like this. You know, King of the Ring is another great example of this, where I'm a big fan of King of the Ring, but if you look at the last few that they've done, you know, they really haven't done a very good job with it. Although I did enjoy the stuff with Gable and Corbin actually in the last one. So I might even make an exception for that, but you go back before that, some of the ones they've done on television in recent years, they've been a waste. If done correctly, I think this stuff could be a lot of fun. But what strikes me when I read these reports, and to kind of piggyback off this talk that there's been about there being a potential WWE sale in the next few years, and the company is being prepped for the highest bidder and all that. And then what happens, right? What if NBC Universal buys them? What if Fox buys them? What if some big media entity were to buy the company? This could be a window into what we could expect. As far as the synergy between properties and everything is all gimmicked up, and we start to see a lot of this, a lot more of this on television, again, it's one of those be careful what you wish for things, because things could actually end up being far worse than they are now if you have a television network or a big media company that buys WWE and thinks, oh, this is great, we'll just do crossovers every week with, you know, my Hello Kitty and all this other, you know, Care Bears or whatever the fuck. The weird things that come to my mind here. Care Bears were a thing when I was a kid. I have no idea if they still exist or not. But they could go a little overboard with that stuff. So, yeah. Got to be careful what we wish for here. Some other Raw notes real quick that I did not cover in my Hell in a Cell review. So if I didn't mention anything big here, it's because I already talked about it before. John Morrison had a match with Jeff Hardy. And he beat Hardy. Miz was out there in a wheelchair with his knee injury. Miz being hurt gave them the chance to finally do something with John Morrison. And it's just more of the same lame comedy garbage, you know, the Johnny Drip Drip stuff that they're really leaning heavily into. Cedric Alexander had cut a promo on Hardy after the match was over. He was very upset that Jeff disrespected him and was a sore winner after the last match they had. He was sorry that he didn't send Jeff to a retirement home. And this led to Jeff challenging him to a match right then and there and saying that if I lose, I'll retire from the ring. And Jeff did, in fact, not lose. And he did not have to retire. But the mere fact that they're even teasing retirement makes me think that retirement may not be too far off for Jeff Hardy, who they have done nothing with since he re-signed. And the feud he had with Sheamus was the last meaningful thing that he did. What has he done since? That was last summer. He has been reduced to jobbing to Jinder Mahal on Main Event. Randy Orton and Riddle beat The New Day in what I thought was easily the best match on the show on Monday. They gave them a lot of time. I liked the finish with Woods rolling right into an RKO. And this was the night Eva Marie made her grand return to the ring on Raw, or was supposed to, against Naomi. Poor Naomi, being fed to the wolves here. The same Naomi who Mustafa Ali said on Twitter is the most underrated female superstar ever in WWE. I would not go that far. Two-time women's champion when there have been other women equally as good or better who never even got to sniff a title or a major storyline. So I would not say the most underrated, but I agree she's definitely undervalued, I think. But here she was on job duty, but not to Eva. Eva came out with Piper Niven from NXT UK. Fightful had reported that Mercedes Martinez and Piper Niven were the two names being bandied about internally as being paired off with Eva. And they went with Niven, but never acknowledged that she was with NXT UK. The announcers had to pretend to not even know who she was. That was very dumb. And I don't want to hear, well, nobody watches NXT UK, so they don't know who she is. Or, oh, you know, Walter has been on Raw and on a Survivor Series show already, so if he came up, they would refer to him by his name. If he's good enough to be called Walter, and he's from the same brand that she is, I don't understand the need to play dumb and pretend that she's an unknown. Oh, hey, that's Piper Niven from NXT UK. What's she doing out there with Eva Marie? Well, Eva Marie just got Niven her big break on Monday Night Raw. That's it. That's all you have to do. Piper Niven wants to be on Raw. Eva Marie is looking to help out the new generation here, right? She's looking to pay it forward. Isn't that what we are supposed to be getting out of these vignettes? And so she's doing a solid for this woman, and she's getting her moved up to the Monday Night Raw roster. She's getting her her big break. That's all you have to do. But no, they have to recreate these people. It's just what they do. It's what they do. And they may yet end up keeping the name. We don't know for sure that she won't be, you know, end up being called Piper Niven. They didn't call her anything on this show. She came to the ring. She beat Naomi quickly on Eva's behalf. Pinned her with a Michinoku driver. And then she is hugging Eva on the outside. She's all excited. Eva looked disgusted by it all, but she had the ring announcer announce herself as the winner. Hey, anything that keeps Eva Marie out of the ring is okay with me. So if that's the gimmick, cool. But you know full well that it's only a matter of time before we have new women's tag team champions. And their name is Eva Marie and Piper Niven. Or should I say, Dewdrop. Feifel was first to report one name that was pitched for Niven was Dewdrop. I don't even know what the fuck that means. It sounds like something that I do in the bathroom. Dewdrop. What kind of meth are these people on? They need the good stuff from Heisenberg. That's 95% pure. The purity of the stuff that they're using is only around 25%. But now I see the WWE has filed a trademark application for the name Dewdrop. So that would seem to confirm things that maybe it's the name of her finishing move. Maybe they call her Piper Niven, but her finishing move is called Dewdrop. I mean, it's very unlikely. That's probably going to end up being her name. But she used the Michinoku driver on Monday. Maybe it's the name of the move. Who knows? We'll see. And I hope for the best for Piper Niven. I hope she ends up being pushed as a big star. But right now, the way things are looking with this gimmick and this name, I mean, it's only been 1 week. So I'm not going to make a final judgment on this, but I don't like where this is headed. Now let's switch gears and talk about All Elite Wrestling, because there was some news this week. Forbes did a big feature story on Tony Khan and the company, and we learned a few things. The company is in the red right now due to an 8-figure investment in their video game development, but Tony Khan expects the company to turn a profit by the end of the year. The Warner Media deal is their biggest revenue driver, although we already knew that. It's worth around $175 million through 2023. And Shad Khan, he didn't think that this would succeed. Maybe he still feels it might not succeed. But he didn't have high hopes for this when his son first came to him and said, hey, I want to start a wrestling company. But he told his son, and this is the quote of the week right here. Actually, this is a very appropriate quote for Father's Day. He told his son, look, when I'm dead and gone, I'm going to be leaving you and your sister a lot of money. Why don't you blow some of that while I'm alive? So not exactly a vote of confidence in this AEW thing. I would think maybe he's come around to the idea by now that he sees it's not a total flop. But I just thought that was a great quote timed for Father's Day. I'm going to be dead soon. I would love to see you and your sister just blow through all the money that I'm going to leave for you. AEW is bringing Dynamite to New York City for the first time on September 22nd for a show they're calling Dynamite Grand Slam from Arthur Ashe Stadium in Flushing, Queens, home of my New York Mets. Citi Field is right there, right in the shadow. Arthur Ashe is a tennis stadium. It hosts the U.S. Open. This will be the first wrestling show ever to be hosted there. It has a capacity of almost 24,000. AEW, though, is setting it up for about 17. Now, I'm sure that if the demand is there, they could open up a few more seats. And they have a retractable roof, so if the weather is nice, they could open it up. Tickets go on sale July 16th. I would be shocked if they don't sell this thing out. First time ever in that venue. New York market coming out of this pandemic. They're going to pack that place in. Not a doubt in my mind. Tony Khan is crediting Raphael Morphy, AEW's director of live events, with making the deal happen. Apparently he's been the point person on this for the past 2 years. And Morphy used to work for WWE in the same role until 2012. I had some interactions with him after that. I don't remember if it was when he was working for Impact or for the New York Cosmos. I think it was the Cosmos. But in any event, he couldn't have been nicer. He's a very impressive guy, and he was a great pickup for AEW. So kudos to them for making this happen, and kudos to him. This could become their home base here in New York if all works out. You know, the way MSG, I was going to say the way MSG is, but really the way MSG used to be for WWE, and today the Barclays Center kind of is for them. This could be that for AEW. And they could actually get more people into Arthur Ashe than WWE can get into either of the other two buildings. They usually set those buildings up for less than the 17,000 that AEW is shooting for here. I mean, usually when they go to the Garden, I'm not even sure what the garden capacity now even is. I mean, they've restructured that building so many times over the years. The old MSG, you can fit between 20 and 30,000. You can't get that many people in there now for a wrestling show in MSG. And the way WWE has the stages and everything, you'd be lucky if you get 15,000 people in that building. Barclays is about the same. So AEW potentially could just, every time they visit the venue, if they come back, it fit more people, in theory, than WWE could. WWE could in their respective buildings. I'm sure if WWE ever wanted to run Arthur Ashe Stadium, they would pack it in, you know, no problem. But Tony Khan says he wants the show to be on par with other special Dynamites they've done, like Winter is Coming and Blood and Guts. And with them being in Queens, and after watching that video package on Dynamite this week with FTR and Santana and Ortiz, the answer about who should be the team to take the tag team titles from the Young Bucks is staring them right in the face. They didn't do it with Moxley and with Eddie Kingston, because I guess Moxley was going away. He was about to have a kid. Santana and Ortiz have never held the AEW tag team titles before. In a lot of ways, I kind of look at them as a hidden gem in that company. And it sounds a little weird to say that because they're on television almost every week. They're part of the biggest faction in the company. But they've kind of, in a way, you know, they've been hidden away with this Inner Circle stuff. They've never really had a proper run for themselves. And they're going to beat FTR. They're going to do that match soon. And then they're coming for the Bucks. And they're coming for those AEW tag team titles. And I think September 22nd in New York City is the perfect place to crown new tag team champions. Now, the week before that kicks off their big Northeast run. September 15th, they're going to be at the Prudential Center in Newark, New Jersey, which was supposed to host the Blood and Guts match last year before COVID ruined everything. The 22nd, as I mentioned, is the Queens show. September 29th, the week after that, is the rescheduled show in Rochester, New York. They really should do something special for Brody Lee on that show. That was his hometown. That was the place where he was supposed to have made his AEW debut. That was the first COVID-canceled show last year. Maybe something involving the TNT title that he held, like an invitational or something where the winner earns the right to challenge for the TNT championship. It could be a battle royal. It could be a tournament. The Brody Lee TNT Invitational. I think that would be a cool thing to do. And then October 6th, my birthday, it'll be in Philadelphia. I didn't realize my birthday was on a Wednesday this year. So I guess we're doing a birthday stream on the YouTube channel this year. So SmackDown Friday night ended with a cage match and Dynamite opened with one. I really liked the MMA cage fight between Wardlow and Jake Hager. I thought they did a very good job of making it look like a fight and just feel like a fight. Just like visually, they transformed the ring basically into an octagon. You know, I used to like the Lion's Den matches that WWE would do with Ken Shamrock, and there weren't very many of them. You know, you do too many and the novelty wears off. If people want real MMA, yes, they will go watch real MMA. I do not want to see a fake MMA division where we get matches like this all the time. But it's okay to try something like this every now and then. The fact that Hager has the MMA background, they kind of played off that a little bit with him and, you know, in Bellator. So that's fine. I have no issue with that. And so what they did here was they had 3 5-minute rounds. Jericho was Hager's corner man. Shawn Spears was the corner man for Wardlow. Wardlow even did this move where he kicked off the cage and landed a Superman punch. They worked wrestling spots in late in the fight, including Wardlow powerbombing Hager into the cage. He followed that up with a running Hurricane Rana, which, yes, looked ridiculous, but it's wrestling. I mean, they do ridiculous shit all the time. I'm not really surprised to see a Hurricane Rana in an MMA fight. Hager got the head and neck choke applied and Wardlow passed out, which gave Hager the win via the ref stoppage. I mean, you knew with Hager's MMA background, he's undefeated in his few fights that he's had. He wasn't going to lose here in this one. So the outcome was pretty predictable, but Spears attacked Hager after Jericho got involved, and that led to MJF running out and attacking Jericho's injured elbow. He put the Salt of the Earth armbar on when Dean Malenko ran in to pull MJF away from Jericho. And Dean Malenko was standing there. MJF looked like he was going to back away, but then he hauled off and he decked Dean Malenko, and Jim Ross was appalled on commentary. He hit a 60-year-old man with Parkinson's disease, he said. It's wild. In the last couple of weeks, we've had, actually in the same week, what am I saying? Is in the same week, days apart, we had 67-year-old Ted DiBiase taking a flat back bump on television, and here we have 60-something-year-old Dean Malenko with Parkinson's taking a bump on TV as well. It's kind of strange. Strange timing on that. But Sammy Guevara ran out. He chased away MJF. The two of them are going to have a match. I believe they're saving it for the June 30th return of Dynamite to Wednesday night. Darby Allin told Sting to stay home this week, and that's what he did. There was no Sting to be found. Sting was sitting at home in his lazy boy with his chips and his salsa. He even painted his face because he can't help himself. To sit there and watch Darby Allin lose to Scorpio Sky and Ethan Page. Darby fought from underneath, which he's great at doing. He's a great scrappy underdog. But the numbers were too much. This was a must-win for the heels. If Scorpio and Ethan Page, they lost at the pay-per-view, if they would have lost 2-1 in this match, then they're done. They're finished. There's nothing left for them to do. So they had to win this match, and they did. I did not like the Orange Cassidy Cesar Bononi match. They did a spot where Bononi was outside the ring with all of his wingmen. That's what they call them, right? Him and Peter Avalon and J.D. Drake and Nick Nemeth. So they're all standing around and they're just posing and celebrating, but it's so hokey. Like, there's no reason for them to be out there doing this. And it's so obvious that they're just stalling for time until Best Friends in the ring can set up to launch Orange Cassidy out of the ring and out onto them so they could catch him. Now, we see this spot in wrestling all the time. We see this spot on Dynamite every fucking week. But this one here, this was just obnoxious. Killed the entire match for me. I fucking hated that spot. I did not like this. Jungle Boy was in the back. He was entering the building. He had his knapsack on. And Kenny Omega, Don Callis, and Michael Nakazawa roll up in a golf cart. And Omega, there's no title. There's nothing. He's ready to throw down with Jungle Boy. He says, I'll even give you the first shot. I'll give you a freebie. And Jungle Boy goes to take the bait, but Nakazawa hits him from behind with his laptop. And Omega, Callis, they jump in the golf cart for the getaway. They will not let Nakazawa in. In fact, Omega pushes him away from the golf cart. He sacrificed Nakazawa, who got beaten up by Jungle Boy. This was their last big kind of promotional push before the AEW title match on Saturday night next week. Saturday Night Dynamite. It's going to be Kenny Omega defending the title against Jungle Boy. We had the debut of Brock Anderson, the son of Arn Anderson, tagging with Cody Rhodes against The Factory, QT Marshall, and Aaron Solo. By the way, Cody and Brandy had their baby this week, a baby girl by the name of Liberty. All I think about when I hear that is those stupid commercials. Liberty, 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 Liberty. It's all I fucking hear in my head. How many fucking times can we see that commercial? So, Liberty is finally here. And of course, you know, and the only appropriate response to this is, congratulations to the new parents. But every fucking tweet that I saw, oh my God, the poison in these comments is just off the charts. What a terrible name. Who comes up with a name like that? They should have done this. They should have named their baby that. It's not your fucking baby. You want to name your baby with some shitty name? Go ahead and have a baby. Go pop one out. You can name it whatever you want. Oh my God, the Cody hate was just, it was magnified this week when the only response is simply, congrats. All good health. All good health to mother and child. I like this match. I thought that, first of all, it is uncanny. I said this last week. There is no paternity test needed to know who Brock Anderson's father is. Okay? He's a dead ringer for Arn Anderson. So he's got a very plain look, as his father did. But I thought he looked pretty good. He looked pretty solid, you know, considering that this was his first televised match. You know, and it was a tag team match, so they can kind of hide him away a little bit. He wasn't completely exposed in their one-on-one. But what we saw from him here, much like I thought what we saw at Double or Nothing with Anthony Ogogo, in what was his first real big match, there's definitely something there. They're very green. They're very inexperienced. And I question putting all of these guys at once on television, one right after the other. It's like Cody's trying to get these guys over. But, you know, you do too many more of these and all the names, they're just going to start to blend together and nobody's going to really stand out. So that's one thing I think you have to be careful of here. But Cody tagged in Brock and late in the match and he was in there. He did have one sloppy looking gut wrench suplex to Aaron Solo, but QT took him down with a double A spine buster and he eyeballed Arn on the outside. QT went for crossroads on Brock, who countered into a DDT. And Cody got the hot tag. He ran wild for a little bit. This all built to Brock tagging back in and getting a jackknife pin on Aaron Solo for the win. Arn Anderson looked like a proud papa when this was over. One down, he said. One down, many more to come. Britt Baker was backstage with Rebel being interviewed by Tony Schiavone when Vicky Guerrero interrupted. She is not happy because she wants the title to come home to Nyla Rose. Baker and Rebel were not taking her seriously, and Vicky said, you know, Tony Khan owes me a favor for bringing in Andrade El Idolo. And next week, it's going to be Britt and Rebel against Nyla and Vicky. Or will it? Or will it? Because we had a sit-down interview shortly after this with Jim Ross and the aforementioned Andrade El Idolo. JR was asking him, why AEW? And he said, AEW has many stars, but he is a superstar. And JR mentioned the AEW title, the TNT title. He assumed that they are on Andrade's radar. Andrade said he deserves opportunities for both belts. They had to use subtitles for a lot of this because his English is just not good. His English is really not that good. Ross asked him about his relationship with Vicky Guerrero, and he mentioned that she understands the business and talked about her lineage, right? He comes from a wrestling family. She was obviously part of a wrestling family. She married into one, and that's why they have such a great connection. But then he said that he and Vicky have a surprise. Didn't say what the surprise was or when we might find out what it is, only that they have a surprise. And right after this interview aired, Thea Trinidad tweeted the word, with a thinking face emoji. Now, she could just be trolling. She could just be fucking around. But I don't want to see Vicky Guerrero in the ring. Under any circumstances. Vicky Guerrero should not be wrestling ever. She did a few times in WWE. That was a few times too many. She has no business being in the ring. So I am hoping. I'm actually hoping for a swerve here. And I would like to see a Thea debut in her place. Or even better, a Thea debut where she ends up outsmarting Vicky and ends up replacing her as Andrade's manager. Because I am still not sold on this pairing between Andrade and Vicky. The one thing that was patently obvious from that promo is that his English is still not great. And until it gets better, he needs somebody to do at least some of the talking. He could say little, you know, bits and pieces here. That's fine. But the majority of the talking for him should not be done by him. The majority of the talking for him should be done by somebody else, and I would much rather that be Thea Trinidad than Vicky Guerrero. If they can get her. Maybe they can't get her. Maybe Thea doesn't want to come in. Maybe she does have a contract with somebody else and Tony Khan's hands are tied. But if they can get her, there's absolutely no reason for them not to bring her in. Penelope Ford got a win over Julia Hart, who had the Varsity Blondes out there in her corner because she's part of their act now. And Penelope won with the Indian Deathlock, locked it on. She refused to let go. Finally, she did relinquish the hold. After the match, Miro walked out. He was asking Penelope where Kip Sabian is. And then he got in the ring. He threw Griff Garrison out of the ring. Brian Pillman Jr. hit a springboard move. The two of them had to be separated. And now they're going to have a TNT title match. I believe on June 30th. I think it's on the 30th. I think they're saving it for that first Wednesday show back, not the 26th. I could have the date wrong on that, but I think it's the 30th. We had the video package I mentioned before. Great video package for FTR and Santana and Ortiz. Just showing the different paths they've taken to where they are today in AEW. We had a backstage segment with Jade Cargill and Mark Sterling, her new manager, who announced their first partnership is with a hotel somewhere in Toronto. Might be the Four Seasons or something. She says her opponents can stay there when she knocks them out. Their discount code is that bitch. It's a lot cooler than my promo code for ExpressVPN and HelloFresh. I'll say that much. Main event was Matt Jackson and the Good Brothers against Eddie Kingston, Penta El Cerro Miedo, and Frankie Kazarian. Some good action here. Karl Anderson and Penta were the legal men left in the ring at the end. Penta hit a backstabber, went to the top rope, and Nick Jackson showed up, and he sprayed Penta in the eyes with that cold spray they use in every single match now. Anderson hit a top rope stun gun for the win. And that was how the show ended. Only one more preemption. No Dynamite on Wednesday. There's no Dynamite on Friday this week. Dynamite airs live on Saturday. And the good news is it's at 8 p.m. start time, not 10 p.m. Which means that I will be live on YouTube on Saturday night after the show goes off the air. You're getting a Saturday night sound off. So you'll get a show on Saturday night, and then I'll be right back with episode 710 on Sunday. So that's something to look forward to next weekend. Now let's talk about NXT. Actually, there's some news that ties into NXT. There were dark matches at SmackDown, at the Thunderdome this week, that did not air on TV. They were taped, but they will not be shown anywhere. This was for internal purposes only. They brought in Karrion Kross, the NXT champion, with Scarlett, and Bronson Reed, the North American champion. Kross had a match, according to PW Insider, against Dolph Ziggler. Bronson Reed had a match with Bobby Roode. One of the reasons they were brought in, and others might be as well in the weeks to come, they may not be the only ones, is WWE was looking to evaluate some of the NXT talent in preparation for this draft that is rumored to be taking place after SummerSlam, end of August, early September. And they are looking potentially at different NXT names that they can call up to the main roster. And I said this last week or 2 weeks ago, I said they almost have no choice, right? Many times they do not include NXT in these drafts or in these roster shakeups, but they have no choice this time. They need to call up new, as much as it pains me and it scares me for some of them, they need new faces, they need new blood, especially new women on these shows. They cannot put it off any longer. NXT has to have a role in this draft. And it looks like this is sort of the beginning of it. But I laugh because as if you needed any more proof that Vince McMahon pays absolutely no attention to NXT, the fact that they would have to bring in their top champion, their top two champions, so that people there can get a look at them, like they're getting a fucking tryout. If that doesn't speak volumes right there, I don't know what does. These guys are on television every single week on the USA Network, the same network that airs Monday Night Raw. The very next night, these guys are on television every single week. They are the champions in that brand, and they have to have tryout matches with Dolph Ziggler and Bobby Roode. Like they're fucking rookies. Unbelievable. So after a good, I wouldn't say great takeover, but a good takeover, NXT left us with a good cliffhanger, though, at the end of that show, with William Regal teasing that his time as general manager may be coming to an end. 7 years, Regal has served as the on-screen GM for NXT. He is approaching Jack Tunney for longest-running authority figure, I believe, in WWE television history. Tunney was the figurehead president from 1984 to 1995. On the take, Tunney, as Bobby Heenan used to call him. So Regal has to, he's got to stick it out for a little bit longer. That way he can break the record. But Regal kicked off the show on Tuesday in tears. Tears in his eyes, talking about being there from the very beginning. He's done commentary. He's called the very first takeover. He got to sit with his nieces and watch an NXT show in his hometown of Blackpool a few years ago. He said, with all of the chaos of late, he has given all he can give. He is no longer capable of giving the fans what they deserve. And when it looked like he was about to resign as the GM, Karrion Kross and Scarlett interrupted. Kross was great here in this segment, just a total douchebag. He called Regal pathetic. He wanted to hear Regal say it. Tell these people you're leaving. Say that Kross was right. Suddenly we hear the music we all knew was coming. Samoa Joe is back with the NXT brand. He marched down to the ring in a suit. He's a suit now. He said Regal wanted to speak with him. Regal said he wanted Joe to take his place as the new general manager of NXT. To which Joe responded, absolutely not. But he will make sure that everybody on the roster respects Regal. So basically, he's agreed to be Regal's enforcer. Regal was intrigued by the idea. He said, though, that the job would come with some conditions. Joe should have said that his only condition is a no-cut contract, but I digress. Regal said Joe cannot be a competitor, which got boos, and he cannot lay his hands on anyone unless, and this is important, unless he is provoked. And Joe accepted those terms. So it is the old Sheriff Austin deal where he couldn't touch anybody unless provoked. And Austin ended up being provoked a whole bunch of times, especially by Coach. Joe then had an intense stare down with Kross, who left the ring. That right there should be your takeover main event, SummerSlam weekend in August. I don't know if Samoa Joe is cleared, medically cleared or not. He did get physical on this show. I don't know if that means he's medically cleared. He didn't take any bumps. Just because they put him in this role does not mean he has not been cleared and that this isn't just an angle to build to a match. I'm hoping that's what it is. I said it last week. I want to see Joe get one more run before all is said and done. I would have preferred that run be on the main roster, but that's not going to happen, obviously. So this is the next best thing. Samoa Joe as NXT champion one more time needs to happen. If he is not cleared, if he has post-concussion issues that he is still dealing with, then that's not good, and then he shouldn't be in the ring until he's ready. But what I know is this. Daniel Bryan had concussion issues and was forced into an early retirement, and then 3 years later, he was back in the ring. Edge was forced into an early retirement, and 9 years later, he was back in the ring, and he's older than Joe is. Samoa Joe's in-ring career is not over. And I'm hoping that this was just the first little tease of what's to come. I'm glad to have him back on TV. PW Insider said that it was Triple H who snatched him back as soon as possible after he was released. You know, because Triple H is someone who respects Joe's body of work. He respects what Joe can bring to the table. He saw it firsthand at NXT the first time. He even signed Joe to a special contract that let him wrestle outside of the company. Who gets that contract? That's the contract that Daniel Bryan is trying to get right now from WWE. He wants to go work in Japan. Joe got that contract until his merchandise got hot and they realized, hey, we should probably sign this guy to a full-time deal. We can make money with him. I trust Triple H to do right by Samoa Joe and use him in a way that he should be used. For now, I think Samoa Joe, the enforcer who lays down the law, is a great role for him. It didn't take long for Joe to be provoked either. Adam Cole and Kyle O'Reilly, they got into it backstage and had to be separated. Regal said next week they would be in singles matches, not against each other. But each man would get to pick their own opponent. They're also going to wrestle each other on the Great American Bash episode of NXT on July 6th. In the pull-apart, Cole shoved Joe, and so Joe retaliated in kind, and he choked out Adam Cole with the Coquina Clutch. Put him out like a father with his newborn. He put him to sleep. Nighty-night. Later in the show, we had a stare-down in Regal's office with Joe and Pete Dunne. No words were exchanged, just some mean mugging going on. That's another match I'd love to see. They're dropping so many little teases here, it would be cruel if Joe was not going to end up back in the ring at some point. Kushida took on another newcomer in his Cruiserweight title open challenge. This week it was Trey Baxter, the former Blake Christian, who signed with the company at the same time Christian Casanova did earlier this year, who lost to Kushida the other week under his new name of Carmelo Hayes. Baxter had been working for New Japan as part of the roster on New Japan Strong. He made some appearances for Impact Wrestling as well before signing here. They had a good match. Kushida retained with the hoverboard lock. Kyle O'Reilly challenged Kushida to a match this Tuesday, I assume non-title. Actually, how much does Kyle O'Reilly weigh? It's got to be under 205. It's got to be under 205, I would think. Right? Let's see. Let me go here to WWE.com and let's take a look in real time. Let's do some research here and see. Kyle O'Reilly's page on the NXT Superstars section. And there is no height and weight on his profile page. Why do I have to go to Wikipedia to get this guy's information? Why does Wikipedia have this and WWE.com doesn't? It's ridiculous. All right, 200 pounds. That's what Wikipedia is telling me, 200 pounds. So he's technically under 205. It could be for the title. But I don't think Kyle O'Reilly is interested in becoming the Cruiserweight champion. They had a $1 million coronation with Ted DiBiase for the new $1 million champion, L.A. Knight, who said that it's not often that you get to meet your heroes. This means the world to him, and DiBiase presented him with the belt and draped it over his shoulder. Pyro shot off. DiBiase did his trademark cackle, and L.A. Knight cackled right along with him. And then Knight said, "I have everything I've ever wanted, and it's time for me to drop what I don't need." And he punched DiBiase, who took a pretty damn good flat back bump at 67 years old. You would almost think this guy was a worker or something. I was legitimately shocked to see DiBiase take a bump. It's probably been, what, over 20 years? 25 years? Since he's taken any kind of real bump? Knight started kicking and stomping on him until Cameron Grimes ran down to make the save and clean house. Clotheslined LA Knight out to the floor. He was checking on DiBiase. You could hear either, I don't know if it was a referee or a cameraman off camera shouting, "Look at Ted! Look at Ted! Look at Ted!" He's trying to get Cameron's attention. Over and over and over at Grimes, who was looking at LA Knight in the aisleway, not at Ted. I like this segment a lot. Not just for the shock value of DiBiase taking a bump, but because LA Knight is a heel. He didn't turn heel on DiBiase. He was already a heel. And heels do heelish things like beat up legends. It got him a ton of heat, and it made Cameron Grimes come off as a huge babyface, which is why I had no issue with him losing that ladder match at TakeOver. LA Knight was absolutely the right choice to win that match. Now Cameron Grimes can chase him for it and maybe even win it from him in front of a bigger crowd that can give him a huge babyface reaction. Although the next TakeOver show in August is tentatively slated for Orlando again, which I hate. I don't want any more TakeOver shows in that building. If they want to do weekly television there, that's fine, but They have got to get those takeovers out of that building and back. I don't even care if it's another little tiny-ass building somewhere. Just get it out of the COVID Coliseum. Right now, it looks like the next one is going to be right back there again. Dakota Kai and Raquel Gonzalez picked up a win over Casey Catanzaro and Caden Carter. Boy, that's a lot of K's. Dakota Kai, Casey Catanzaro, Caden Carter. Boy, Raquel is the odd person out here. Good stuff from these two teams. Kai and Gonzalez are being built up for a tag team title match against The Way. And I'm torn. I'm torn. When the split eventually happens with Kai and Gonzalez, Kai turning on Raquel and making Raquel the babyface, kind of, you know, Dakota turning on her more out of jealousy, that would make sense. But Dakota Kai is a great babyface. And I think you could easily go the other way with it and have Raquel destroy her at some point as just dead weight that she doesn't need anymore. And we get babyface Dakota trying to be the person to kind of slay her own Frankenstein monster that she helped create and win her first NXT championship. I kind of like that idea. So I don't know. I don't know which way I would choose. Speaking of The Way, Candice LeRae interrupted Io Shirai, her promo in the ring, and Indy Hartwell sneak attacked Io. Io was making her own comeback, but she got overwhelmed until Zoe Stark ran down to make the save. So it looks like we're getting a tag team match, playa. We're getting a tag team match soon. It looked like there was a little production snafu where Mackenzie Mitchell was trying to get an interview with William Regal and Samoa Joe as they were leaving the building in the middle of the show. As Regal went to speak, they quickly cut to another pre-tape. They cut to another segment. And then later, when they went back to Regal and Joe, they were back in their office. So they came back into the building, apparently. And maybe they were going out for a smoke break. I assume what happened is that was supposed to air at the end of the show, and someone sneezed and hit the wrong button. But we still had a main event yet to come. Tommaso Ciampa and Timothy Thatcher against grizzled young veterans in a Tornado tag team match. This match here was takeover worthy. Tornado rules mean a lot of wild brawling, and this match had plenty of that. The vets were setting up Ciampa for a doomsday device when Thatcher saved, and instead Ciampa hit an air raid crash off the ropes for a near fall. The veterans did eventually hit the doomsday, but on the floor, with Drake diving through the ropes and taking Ciampa over, and then moments later Ciampa dropped Zach Gibson onto the announce desk with an air raid crash. The table did not break. In the ring, Ciampa hit Drake with the... We've already had enough legends taking bumps this week. Leave Jake Roberts alone. Or Jake Atlas, I guess. I guess there is another Jake. But Ciampa hit Drake with the fairy tale ending and locked on an armbar at the same time that Timothy Thatcher put Drake in an ankle lock. And Drake tapped out to the double submission. A fine ending, a very, very good match, a very strong episode, I thought, of NXT coming off that takeover show. Samoa Joe is back as Regal's enforcer. Karrion Kross now is firmly planted in the heel camp. There is no more wondering, oh, is he a babyface? Is he a heel? Is he a tweener? At least we now know what he is. And I love the tease for an eventual match with Joe. Great stuff with Knight and Grimes in the segment with DiBiase. I like where that's going. And a very good main event. Makes this show an easy thumbs up. I watched the two-hour Vice TV documentary on China, Joni Lauer, which is one of the saddest things that I've ever seen. This was a woman who attained superstardom in a relatively short period of time. She got cheated on by the love of her life, and then was effectively blackballed from the company that she called home. And everything just seemed to spiral out of control from there. And what's worse is that she didn't have the support system that she really needed to climb out of it. She was surrounded by enablers who just leached off of her up until the day she died. She had her demons, there's no doubt about that. I mean, they're very well documented. She had her issues. She had her sense of what her worth was, which is what led to WWE letting her go. You know, whether she was actually worth $1 million a year is something that can be debated. They said that she wanted Steve Austin level money, which is ridiculous. And I cannot fault WWE for not seeing her at Steve Austin level, because almost nobody, except maybe The Rock later on, was at Steve Austin level in that company. Steve Austin was a star that just transcended the company and transcended the business. There was nobody else like him at that time. Her sister, who was interviewed for this special, said that, and this was in an interview she did a few years ago, and Jim Ross has since confirmed this as well, that the company had offered China a new deal in 2001 to keep her, where she would make no less than $400,000. So I guess $400,000 would have been the base salary that she would have made, with the potential for a lot more money between pay-per-view money and merch sales, and she turned it down. She wanted a base salary of $1 million. And when it comes to dollars and cents, you know, relative to what she was doing on television at that time, yeah, that sounds ridiculous. But consider this. Consider this. Had there been a healthy WCW at that time, or an AEW like there is today, where it wasn't all that long ago that WWE was throwing around just these types of outrageous numbers at people like FTR and Gallows and Anderson just to keep them from going to AEW. If there was anyone else around that time, 20 years ago, China probably could have gotten herself a $1 million deal to stay with WWE, or something close to that, because I don't think they would have wanted to lose her to their competitor. She was a big enough name still that I don't think they would have wanted to lose her to someone else. But there was no one else, so they didn't have to worry about losing her to anyone. Timing is everything. And the fact that WCW and ECW both went out of business that year, you know, TNA and Ring of Honor didn't even exist until the following year. She sort of fell into this donut hole where there was nowhere else in wrestling for her to go to make that kind of money that was even comparable to what WWE could pay her. She could go do Playboy, and she did. She could do porn, and she did many years later and make a lot of money really quickly. But in wrestling in 2001, it was WWE and that was it. And you just watch this documentary and 15 years go by. 15 years where she just falls deeper and deeper into this hole. You know, they had footage of her wrestling Masahiro Chono in New Japan. They had a competitive match. But she didn't stick around, and then TNA brought her in, and they didn't mention this, but TNA did bring her in once. They did bring her in for a pay-per-view match in 2011, and she was gone quickly after that. I don't recall what the reason was, if it was a money issue, or if it was just agreed upon that she would do one match and that was going to be it. But she came in, and she was gone right after. Outside of those two things, she was completely out of wrestling for those 15 years. Because she was never going to get the same kind of money that she thought she should be paid in WWE. But Mick Foley was interviewed, as was Vince Russo, who I thought came across better in this documentary than any of the Dark Side of the Ring episodes or any other documentary I've ever seen him in. And they both said, you know, the saddest thing may have been that, or one of the saddest things, was that she died not fully realizing the impact that she had on a lot of people and a lot of female fans, some of whom are now wrestlers, because she was such a huge star when they were growing up and they looked up to her. They sort of idolized her and wanted to be just like her. They wanted to be the next China. And she never really understood how much love there was for her, in part because WWE didn't want to have anything to do with her. It's like being cut out of the will. When you're out, you're out. Out of sight, out of mind. And WWE had many reasons to not want to do business with her later on because the woman was a fucking train wreck. Let's just call it what it is. You don't have to dance around it. There were several years there where the woman was a fucking train wreck. You see it in the documentary. She was out of control. She was drinking, she was taking pills, she was on celebrity rehab at her worst. She was making all sorts of accusations about Triple H and Sean Waltman. And her and Waltman, you know, he's interviewed too, and they had a completely toxic relationship. They were both doing drugs and hiding it from each other at the same time. But, you know, at one point she accused Triple H of physical, like domestic abuse and stuff, which I think she may have eventually apologized for. But, like, there was just a lot of shit that was said and a lot of shit that she was doing. I don't blame WWE for not wanting to bring her back when she was like that. But if she would have gotten the help that she needed, she might still be here today. Can never be sure. I can't sit here and say, oh, China would still be alive if she would have just gotten help. Maybe she would be, maybe she wouldn't. Maybe she would have fallen off the wagon again. We see it time and time again. You look at people like Scott Hall and Jake Roberts and Tammy Sitch, and you want them to get their shit together and get their life back on track and do well, but they just keep falling off. That's why it's so cool to see Jake. And I think even Scott, and they both still fall off the wagon every now and then, or Scott does, but they're definitely in a better place now than they were years ago. You know, when you're an addict, you have to want to help yourself. Jake Roberts has talked about this. You have to want help. DDP did not hit him over the head with a frying pan and drag him to his crib in Atlanta. Jake had to want to move into that house with him and put the work in. China seemingly wanted to be helped. She said as much in some of the documentary footage. But she was surrounded by people who were more interested in shooting their fucking movie than actually wanting to get her clean and sober. Because clean and sober doesn't make for an interesting documentary, I guess. The footage they used was from the aborted China documentary that never got finished. It never got released officially, but they had a ton of unused footage. And she was filming this documentary at the time of her death. So they had a lot of really good footage in here, tough as it was to watch. But until now, people had never really seen all of this video. They had early footage of her on the independent scene from 1995. That was tremendous. I had never seen that before. And she looked like a totally different person. I thought she looked great. I mean, she looked like, if they would have had a strong women's division back then, she would have been the number one star. I thought that some of that footage was the best stuff on here. It talked about how she approached Triple H at the gym one day about possibly being a bodyguard for him. You cannot understate how important that China character was to Triple H's career. China helped make that man a star. And maybe he would have ended up right where he is anyway and fallen for Stephanie. Maybe all of that would have happened no matter what. But Triple H was a mid-card guy on the roster until China came along, and their act just clicked. It just worked. It was money. And it helped elevate him to another level that up to that point in the couple of years he had been in that company, and the curtain call didn't help. He got punished for that. But up to that point, he was at a certain level and he wasn't really getting any higher. And until China came in, that's what really elevated him. Okay, now we can move up a level. It's like being in a video game, right? You start on level 1, you want to get to level 10, but you're stuck on level 3 and you don't know what to do. China comes along and now she helps get this guy up to level 5 or 6. She was an important part of his career. And then he fell in love with Stephanie, and it all fell apart. You know, the heart wants what the heart wants, I guess, but it was a tough spot for her to be in when you get dumped for the boss's daughter. I mean, how do you overcome that awkwardness? You know, now we know that Triple H and Stephanie were together through a good part of 2000, but they talk in the documentary, it wasn't until a year in that China, you know, found a love letter that Stephanie had written to him, and that's kind of when everything came to a head. I mean, you talk about being in an awkward spot. And, you know, when you're looking at Stephanie and you're looking at China and you're saying, well, who's the one that's going to be protected here in this situation? It ain't going to be China. It's going to be Vince McMahon's daughter. That's who it's going to be. And I'm going to say something nice about Vince Russo, because he does come across in this special as someone who genuinely cared about China and wanted to help her. One of the few friends that she had left. But her manager, Anthony, this guy comes across as just a total scumbag who exploited her. You know, she comes back from Japan, where she went to Japan. She was living there for a while. She became a school teacher. She was teaching English to Japanese students. She comes back to the U.S., and they start to film the comeback tour, right? They start to film the documentary, and we're going to take China back out on the road here, and he's got her doing Comic-Cons, and this woman is clearly not ready to be doing these events. She is not in a state mentally where she's ready for this and to be back out in front of fans. There was a really sad scene at one of the Comic-Cons where this woman walks up to China at her table to get an autograph and just starts talking to her. And I'm looking and I'm like, oh, that's Ashley Massaro. So that was really sad to see the two of them together, knowing how both of their stories turned out. But he's got her doing all of these things. He takes her to her father's gravesite, right? To get over these demons, you've got to embrace your past and forgive people. And, you know, he films her at the cemetery and she's sitting there crying her eyes out at her father's gravesite. He tried to organize a reunion with her mother, who she hadn't seen in 30 years. And that ends up not happening because China's a mess at the time. He and China, they have this on film, are doing a fucking Skype call with Dr. Drew. I guess maybe that's from the celebrity rehab connection from when she was on the show, but they're talking to Dr. Drew about needing more pills for her to take, and he's warning them that this combination of drugs can be lethal. It's a bad idea. And this guy keeps pushing to get the pills. Like, he was a total enabler. Plain and simple, he was an enabler. You see the woman needs help now. You try to get her help now, not when you're done with your film. And she's a grown woman. She can make her own choices. But when she came back from Japan, I think that if she had just had the right people around her and wasn't filming this stupid documentary, she would have had a fighting chance at cleaning herself up. You know, Eric, the director of the film, ended up being charged with drug possession and distribution. He was a fucking mess. He at least admitted that he did nothing to try to save her. Because he too was a drug addict at the time. He could barely save himself, let alone her. At least he admits it. Anthony the Vulture got permission from China's mother to cremate her daughter's ashes. Actually, let me back up a little bit here. Because if you recall, when China passed away, it was Anthony. It was her manager here. Her, or as he says, her soulmate. You fucking break. Who goes to her apartment, right? Because no one's heard from her. China's lawyer reached out and says, have you heard from Joni? It's been days I haven't heard from her. Nobody's heard from her. So what does he do? He takes the camera. He's got a camera person filming as he is entering the apartment and following him into the apartment. I'm pretty sure he has it on film when he discovered her body in her bedroom. That did not air on television. There was no way they would have aired that. But I believe it was filmed because the whole trip into the apartment to what he found was filmed. That's how this guy thinks. So now she's dead. And he gets permission from China's mother to cremate her daughter's ashes, right? With 3/4 of them to be spread out in the ocean. And the rest would be sent to China's mom. Instead, he kept half of the 3/4, I guess, that were supposed to be scattered. And then we had footage of him holding a memorial service for China, where he placed the ashes in this bedazzled urn for fans to stand next to and take pictures. At her most vulnerable, she was surrounded by the worst type of people that she could have possibly surrounded herself with, who did absolutely nothing. They did the bare minimum to try to help this woman. And that was the saddest part of all. You know, her run was brief, where she really got hot in WWE and became a big name. It was brief. It was a brief run, but she made a lasting impact. And it's too bad that she's not around today, and not just around, but of sound body and mind, to fully appreciate that. And one more thing here, and we'll put a bow on this. Because I was going to mention the fact that I had watched the latest WWE Most Wanted Treasures episode on Andre the Giant, which was also 2 hours. And I thought it was very well done. But they had they basically sent the AEW crew of Big Show and Mark Henry, along with old AJ Francis, out to go find certain Andre collectibles, right? They were looking for, you know, his singlet, and they were looking for all kinds of, you know, his passport and stuff. So anyway, they end up at Sonny Ono's house. You remember Sonny, if you were a WCW fan, you probably heard of the name Sonny Ono. And they brought Sonny, and Sonny was a friend of Eric Bischoff's, and he was also an on-air manager. But apparently he's also an avid collector. And he came into possession, I assume he paid for it from someone, he bought it off someone many years ago, one of the rare masks that are still out there of Giant Machine. When Andre was doing this gimmick, there was a tag team called The Machines, WWE, they got the idea, I think, from Japan. And for a period of time when Andre in storyline was suspended, he would show up in this mask as Giant Machine. So they had The Machines and he was Giant Machine. At one point there was Hulk Machine. And you knew who it was. I mean, you knew who was under the mask. So there's a few of them. There's a few masks that are out there of Giant Machine that Andre wore. And Sonny Ono is in possession of one of them. And they desperately want to get the Giant Machine mask. So they go to Sonny Ono's house. And they find the mask, and there it is, and, you know, Mark Henry is getting all Mark Henry got emotional in every scene in this episode. I mean, I love Mark Henry, but it got comical. Like, the name Andre would be mentioned, and Mark would have to excuse himself. Like, the tears would begin to flow. He's a very emotional person. He's a very emotional guy. Big Show, I thought, actually came off really well. In this episode, he seemed genuinely interested in wanting to leave, you know, Sonny's house with that mask. But they come to find out that Sonny has organized an auction. And now they're going to have to bid against a couple of super fans, a couple of other, you know, collectors who also want to buy the mask. And so we have video, and I'll tell you how this connects to China here in a second, but they are, you know, bidding against these random fans. And then finally, like, the bidding gets up to like 5,000 and they can't do it. I love it. I love how WWE, we're on a fixed budget here. We can't afford this. So they lose out on the auction to one of these fans. WWE, well, we can't go above this, you know, budget cuts, I guess, right? It can't go above this number. And, they go out to the car, right? Now they're really upset that they didn't get the mask. And they cut to AJ, who, you know, is doing an interview explaining why he is so upset. And there's AJ on screen talking about how angry he is. Sonny Ono, this is not even his mask. It was Andre's mask. And he's being so greedy. He's profiting off of someone's legacy. He is appalled that Sonny Ono is profiting off of someone else's legacy. And I tweeted this out. I said, that is WWE's entire fucking business model. And this clown is getting upset that, oh, Sonny Ono, how could he do such a thing? What a terrible person. He's profiting off of the legacy of Andre the Giant. WWE constantly profits off the legacy of pretty much anybody who ever worked for them. And China, if you'll remember a few years ago, is one of those people. And this is when, remember, WWE had no relationship with China, although I think she had passed away by this point. It is funny how after she passed away, right, they suddenly became very open to putting out China merch and putting her in the Hall of Fame as part of DX, right? They waited until she was dead, and then all of a sudden, oh, well, we're gonna celebrate the life of the ninth wonder of the world. They put out a fucking custom championship belt, a China belt, because they make so much money off these replica belts They profited off of her legacy. Somebody should go ask old AJ how he feels about that. Because he seemed genuinely upset about this. And I'm just thinking, dude, are you out of your fucking mind? Do you know who you work for now? Holy shit. I couldn't believe my ears. But otherwise, I thought it was a very enjoyable episode.
History has been made here!
This week in wrestling history takes us back 42 years ago on June 15th, 1979. A match that is considered to have given birth to what is the modern hardcore style of wrestling took place in Tupelo, Mississippi, with Jerry Lawler and Bill Dundee defending the Southern Tag Team titles against the team of Larry Latham, who would go on to become one of the Moondogs, Moondog Spot, and Wayne Farris, better known years later as the Honky Tonk Man. Think about that. The Honky Tonk Man, in a roundabout kind of way, gave birth to Nick Gage. You can draw the lines connecting one to the other. This was the famous concession stand brawl, which is wild. If you've never seen it before, you can find it on YouTube. I mean, there have been a whole bunch of concession stand brawls, but this is the one that you want to look up. Jerry Lawler once said, "I always look back and say that that was the start of hardcore extreme wrestling." Nobody had ever seen anything like this before. You know, in that Memphis territory, you had a lot of wild brawls, but nothing ever on this scale. Jerry Jarrett was the booker. Business at the time was not good. They were losing talent. This match was really an act of desperation more than anything else. By the time the match was over, there was blood and mustard smeared all over the place. Lance Russell had his famous call of mustard everywhere. Lawler said the promoter, a man by the name of Herman Sheffield, was running up and down the entire time screaming, not about the mustard, not about the candy bars. All he asked is, "Please, don't break my popcorn machine." Lawler said that was his lifeblood as the promoter, was that popcorn machine, and he couldn't afford for it to be broken. So he was begging them not to break it. Tape of the match was shown unedited on television the next day on Memphis TV and was all anybody was talking about. Jarrett booked return matches in every town in the territory, and wouldn't you know, attendance increased steadily to where they were packing in about 7,000 or 8,000 people in those buildings when, before the Tupelo Brawl, the crowds had dwindled to under 4,000. So it worked. And just to piggyback on the point about it being the genesis of modern hardcore wrestling, as Lawler says it was, they did another concession stand brawl in Tupelo a couple of years later with a young Atsushi Onita tagging with Masa Fuchi against Eddie Gilbert and Ricky Morton. Fuchi and Onita were sent to the U.S. to get more seasoning before they were brought back to Japan. And Onita went back to All Japan years later. Physically, he was a wreck by that point. He was very limited in what he could do. But it is very likely that his experience in that territory, and specifically the concession stand brawl, coupled with the fact that he had to find a way to compensate for his bad knees, is what gave rise to his FMW promotion in the 90s with all of the barbed wire and the exploding, you know, death matches they did. You could trace, as far as Onita's career, you could trace it all back to the Tupelo Brawl that he was in the Tennessee territory. 27 years ago this week, on June 19th, 1994, Owen Hart followed in the footsteps of Big Brother Brett and won the King of the Ring tournament, the first and only time that two brothers have won the tournament. But were it not for a very good WWF title match between Bret Hart and Diesel, the first in a series of three matches that they would have from 94 to 95, the other two, one was at the Royal Rumble, the other was at Survivor Series the following year. Were it not for the match they had here on this show here would have been at all-time bad. Not as bad as the 95 King of the Ring. That's the all-time worst. But it would have been all-time bad. As it was, the show was pretty bad. And it was also the first pay-per-view that Vince McMahon missed attending live as he underwent neck surgery for a herniated disc the Monday before this. The announce team, oh boy, the announce team was made up of Gorilla Monsoon, Macho Man Randy Savage, and Art Donovan. Or as Monsoon called him at one point, Art O'Donnell, who was a local legend in Baltimore, football legend. Baltimore is where the pay-per-view took place. Donovan is in the NFL Hall of Fame. He played for the Baltimore Colts. He was, you know, obviously a well-known player in the area, but he knew nothing about the product, as was evidenced when he saw, for example, Lex Luger, one of the biggest stars in the company, and he asked Monsoon, "Hey, Gorilla, what's the guy with the American flag on his shirt? Who's that guy? Who's the guy with the flag?" When he saw IRS, he asked, "Randy, is this one of the wrestlers? He looks like a businessman." When Diesel came to the ring, right, he had Shawn Michaels in his corner, and he asked if Shawn Michaels was also a wrestler. I mean, I don't know what would lead you to believe that when you see this guy coming down to the ring dressed the way that Shawn Michaels used to be dressed. I don't know what else he would be if not a wrestler, but Art Donovan wanted to know, who is this guy? And after the match was over, when the referee took the title away from Diesel because he didn't win it, he was shouting that the referee was stealing the belt. Of course, more famously, he also repeatedly asked, "How much does this guy weigh?" He asked this about every single wrestler in every single match. To the point where Monsoon and Savage started to actively ignore him and pretend he didn't even exist. You almost felt bad for the guy. I laughed out loud when they had one of the on-screens for Monsoon and Savage and Donovan, where they put the camera on them. And as they're trying to ignore him, the camera very slowly kind of like zooms in just on Monsoon and Savage and totally cuts Donovan out of the view. I just like, you know, I watched this. I don't remember the last time I watched this pay-per-view. It wasn't that long ago. Maybe a year or two ago. But you watch this. I have no idea why they didn't give this guy the hook after the first match. Like, you know, on occasion they'll bring in celebrities and other people to do guest commentary, but usually it's just for a match, not for the entire show. The whole pay-per-view is like this. Awful. The previous Monday is when the company debuted its new generation slogan. Remember the new generation of the WWF? That was in 94. Well, that whole campaign only debuted a week before this, in response to WCW signing Hulk Hogan, I'm sure. Either that or the timing was just one hell of a coincidence. So you can imagine what must have been going through Todd Pettengill's mind or being yelled into his earpiece during the show when they cut to him interviewing the governor of Maryland, Bill Schaefer, who was in the crowd. And Todd asked if he was rooting for Roddy Piper or Jerry Lawler in the main event. And Schaefer said he was pulling for Piper, but he was an old Hulk Hogan man himself. And Todd nervously laughed as he brought an abrupt close to the interview. This was cut from the home video release of this show, and at least at one point, I know it was not included in the WWE Network version. I don't know if it made the cut now on Peacock or not. Lawler and Piper had a horrendous main event. Piper, I know Piper had a hip replaced later that year, so he probably had no business being in the ring to begin with. By the way, I love all the new generation talk on this show with two 40-year-olds wrestling in the main event. 25 years ago this week, On June 16th, 1996, WCW hosted one of its all-time best pay-per-views with the Great American Bash from Baltimore. Some great wrestling coupled with some memorable angles make the show a must-see. Dean Malenko retained the Cruiserweight title over Rey Mysterio Jr. in the best match on the show. Crazy to be talking about Rey Jr. here in 96 when I just watched him in a Hell in a Cell match on SmackDown in 2021. Actually, come to think of it, we saw Dean Malenko on Dynamite Friday night, the same night. Holy shit. That's right. That's right. Here's Dean Malenko after the MMA fight with Hager and Wardlow getting involved and taking a bump from MJF. His Dynamite aired on Friday night this week. So we went back to back on Fox and TNT just the other night with Rey Jr. in a Hell in a Cell main event. And then in the opening match on Dynamite, which also was a cage match, a cage fight, there was Dean Malenko. How about that? But these guys were tearing it up in 96 here at the Great American Bash. Chris Benoit pinned Kevin Sullivan in one of my favorite WCW matches of all time. Falls count anywhere in the building. They brawled into the men's bathroom with real fans in there. And Dusty Rhodes on commentary lost his mind when he spotted a woman in the men's room. He's shouting, "There's a lady! There's a lady in the men's bathroom! Looky there! She just stopped off! She just stopped off! She said, I gots to get me some relief!" And then he shouted, he wanted them to fight across the road to the women's bathroom. Let's see what that one looks like. Old perverted Dusty over here. Dusty was great. Dusty could be very hit or miss on commentary. I was a fan of Dusty Rhodes on commentary. I just found him very entertaining more often than not. But this was peak Dusty. Like, if Bobby Heenan, if his peak performance was the 92 Royal Rumble match, I would argue, I would dare say that this match here at the Great American Bash, this was peak Dusty on commentary. Benoit placed, once they brawled back to the ring, Benoit placed a table across the top rope in the corner like a platform, an elevated platform. And he superplexed Sullivan off for the win. After the match, Benoit, he was continuing to attack Sullivan when Arn Anderson ran down to the ring. And he shoved Benoit away to get him, you know, off of Sullivan and teased turning on him because they were together, you know, in the Horsemen. But instead, he and Benoit started putting the boots to Sullivan. And my God, the crowd reaction to this was glorious. Then the rest of the Dungeon of Doom lumbered down to the ring and the Horsemen bailed. The Horsemen and the Dungeon of Doom, they had forged an alliance months before this to fight off the power of Hulkamania, brother. Remember the alliance to end Hulkamania? Well, spoiler, it didn't. But the two factions had come together to try to take out Hulk Hogan and his buddies. But there was no alliance between these two groups any longer after this. There is no honor among thieves. Or heels, in this case. Flair and Arn Anderson beat the NFL All-Star team of Steve Mongo McMichael and Kevin Green, with Mongo turning on Green and becoming the fourth member of the Horsemen. And whatever you thought of Mongo as a Horseman, the turn was well done. It was a well-done angle. And in the big angle on the show, Eric Bischoff had told Scott Hall and Kevin Nash on Nitro the previous week to go ahead and show up at the Bash. And he would let them know which three WCW names they would be fighting. And with WWE threatening a lawsuit against WCW for trying to deceive the viewing public into believing that they were invading on behalf of WWE, Bischoff asked each of them point blank, "Do you work for the WWF?" Hall said no, Nash said no, and they quickly moved on from it. Just had to get that out there. Just had to get that out of the way as a formality, I guess. Bischoff, though, said that he couldn't tell them who the three names would be until Nitro the next night. Only that the match would take place at the Bash at the Beach, but he couldn't tell them who. And Hall said, "You don't jerk us around." And he buried a right hand right in Bischoff's gut and bent him over. Nash grabbed Bischoff, powerbombed him off the stage through a stack of gimmick tables that were set up to look like they were part of the stage. So he went right through them. It looked great. I mean, Bischoff got folded up like an accordion. It looked dangerous as all hell. It was an impressive bump. And it was a major bump for an authority figure to take, even though Bischoff was still an announcer at the time. People knew that, you know, he was the president of the company. Or a lot of people knew anyway, maybe not everybody knew. But this was very well done. 4 days later, on June 20th, 25 years ago, in fact, to this very day, WWE did indeed file suit against WCW, Eric Bischoff and Turner Broadcasting, to try to stop the NWO angle. A lawsuit and a restraining order both were filed. Imagine how different things might have turned out had they succeeded. Had they gotten what they wanted in halting this entire angle. In a press release, Vince McMahon said that he regretted having to take this step, but, and I quote, "I have finally been pushed up against the wall with no other options to protect my company. My wife and I have committed our adult lives to building the World Wrestling Federation. This company competes very well, and I dare say stays ahead in a marketplace where quality of programming, creativity, star development, and consumer interest reflect success. However, when a giant competitor uses your very creations to dupe and confuse the public, then the playing field isn't level and you are forced to fight in a different arena." WWE lawyer Jerry McDevitt, in court, said, "It's like Batman or Superman. We created these characters and wrestling fans have come to associate them with the WWF. Why would anyone like Ted Turner pay them $750,000 a year, put them in the trade dress of Diesel and Razor Ramon, and not give them a name?" And he said, "If this portrayal of Hall and Nash does not stop, the way it affects the WWF is incalculable." 4 years later, in August of 2000, the suit was finally settled out of court, and one rumor, and I can't confirm whether or not this part is true, is that one of the terms of the settlement was that WWE would have the right of first refusal should WCW ever be put up for sale. And it wasn't long after that that the company was in talks about a sale. With Vince McMahon, in fact. And those talks stalled, which is when Bischoff and Fusion Media entered the picture and they thought they had a done deal. They even, you know, publicly said that it was pretty much a done deal, except it wasn't a done deal. And in the end, Vince got it anyway. He got it on the cheap. 23 years ago this week, on June 14th, 1998, WCW presented the Great American Bash from Baltimore, Maryland. If you were to stop watching this show after Goldberg picked up the 100th victory of his career over Conan, you would think this was a very good show. You might even think this was an excellent show. Unfortunately, there were three matches that came after that. Booker T beat Chris Benoit to win their best of seven series and then went on to beat Fit Finlay later in the night to win the WCW television title. Chris Kanyon defeated Perry Saturn. Very good stuff. As was Chris Jericho against Dean Malenko. Juventud Guerrera against Reese, not so much, with a horribly botched Hurricanrana finish. But then Goldberg, hot as he was at the time, and he was white hot, beat Conan to move to 100-0. But then came Bret Hart and Hollywood Hogan beating Roddy Piper and Randy Savage, who had no business being in the ring as Savage needed reconstructive knee surgery. So, of course, he wrestled not one, but two matches. He wrestled twice in a row. After he and Piper lost, they wrestled each other, and Savage lost again. He lost both matches by submission. And he didn't wrestle again until the following year. I think he actually might have had both knees operated on. And in the main event, Sting beat the Giant, get this, in a singles match for control of the tag team titles. Sting and Giant had won the belts. Giant was part of the NWO Black and White squad. Sting declined to, join the Black and White. He ended up being part of the Wolfpack, Red and Black. Giant then tried to replace Sting, the wrestler, not the singer, with Bryan Adams. Again, the wrestler, not the singer. Now that I think about it, WCW missed a huge opportunity for a celebrity tag team match with Sting and Bryan Adams against Sting and Bryan Adams. 24 hours later, Stone Cold Steve Austin and The Undertaker fought Kane and Mankind to a no contest in the first ever Hell in a Cell match to take place on Monday Night Raw. It was only the second ever Hell in a Cell match, period, but the first to air on television, which is appropriate given that we just had Roman Reigns against Rey Mysterio on SmackDown Friday night in the first Hell in a Cell match ever on SmackDown, and the first one to ever air on network television. This episode also gave us the first ever tag team Royal Rumble match, with the winners becoming number one contenders to the tag team titles, which was won by Kane and Mankind. So those two made history twice that night. 20 years ago this week, on the June 18th, 2001 episode of Raw is War, the big reveal of the creep who had been stalking The Undertaker and his then-wife, Sarah. Probably not a wise move to get your wife's name tattooed across your Adam's apple. Especially if you're The Undertaker, he had already been divorced once before. I mean, you hope for the best, but you have to know that if it happened once, it could happen again. I don't know of all the places on your body why you would think it's a good idea to tattoo this woman's name across your neck like that, but to each their own. These segments had started airing on television, showing some mysterious person with his voice distorted, watching Sarah Undertaker, her every move. He was eavesdropping on her during the day, sometimes in the evening, showing her on her exercise bike, in the backyard playing with their dog. He was even in their house at one point going through her panties. The distorted voice was Vince McMahon. Somebody at the time had slowed the audio down and uploaded it online. I remember this being a really big deal in the community of internet fans at that time. Finally, though, it was time for the big reveal. The person rode down to the ring on a motorcycle, just like The Undertaker did at that time. He was wearing a black trench coat and a ski mask. We couldn't see who it was. And he stood in the middle of the ring. The lights went dark. And then the lights came on. And we see this, you know, basically this disguised hooded figure in the ring, and he reaches up into the air, and he reaches down slowly, and he yanks the mask off his head to reveal Diamond Dallas Page. Three-time WCW champion, Diamond Dallas Page, who said that he went after The Undertaker because he was the top dog, and that's what you do to make yourself famous. Now, that explanation actually is not a bad one to run with, that he was only doing it to get in Undertaker's head and play mind games and get under his skin. You know, he doesn't care about Sarah. You know, he's got fucking Kimberly at home. What does he need Sarah for? But they continue to lean into the stalking stuff. I remember DDP had a shrine built to her. This is after he was already revealed. Just complete garbage. This whole thing was fucking garbage. The invasion was just botched beyond belief, and so was DDP in WWE. And as usual, Bruce Pritchard is so far up his own ass. In every clip I've ever heard of him discussing this, I swear to God, he could give himself a free colonoscopy without having to bill his insurance company. He claims DDP was never going to get over in WWE. Yet, if you watch this reveal, it was the only highlight of this entire angle. The reaction he got that night was huge. He absolutely came across like a star. I know this is going to come as a shock to a lot of you, but Bruce Pritchard is full of shit. In WCW, DDP, he was the babyface for the people, right? They called himself the People's Champion. So what do? They turn him into a fucking Peeping Tom. And the saddest part of this whole run there was that he was one of only two big names from WCW who actually cared enough to want to be there. It was DDP and Booker T. Those two guys gave up a lot of money, a lot of guaranteed money, to get out of their contracts with Turner to come work for Vince McMahon. And age played a factor as well. DDP told Gary Cassidy of Inside the Ropes that, look, at the time he was 45 years old and he was not getting any younger, and he felt that it was a now or never type of thing. But WCW had owed him more than $1.2 million. When he walked away from $487,000 to come work for WWE because he knew that they wanted him. He just didn't know what they wanted him for. It was a far cry from the idea that he had, and I know he's talked about this in numerous interviews before, but you know, his whole thing was doing a People's Champ versus People's Champ angle with The Rock. And I know that he had gotten away from that character towards the end of his run in WCW. He was doing the Jersey Triad stuff. There was a lot of shit that happened at the end of WCW that I think a lot of people would rather forget. The Goldberg heel turn. I mean, we can go down a whole fucking list of dumb shit they did. But it almost doesn't even matter. You know what I mean? Like, you bring him in, trust me, all it would have taken was one promo to set that thing up. And at 45, that would have been the time to do it. You bring him in, you go right for the big match, because he's not getting any younger. His body was already breaking down on him. He had injuries were starting to mount. It really was a now or never type of thing. And they were heading into SummerSlam, and you can't tell me that wouldn't have been a great main event or co-main event for SummerSlam in 2001. I think that would have been a fine choice. But it was not to be. And within weeks, DDP was being pinned in the ring on TV by Sarah Undertaker. And he and Undertaker, I don't recall them ever having a proper one-on-one match together. Ever. Officially. I wouldn't even call... What happened at the King of the Ring in 01 wasn't even a match. It was a fight. Undertaker came out, beat the fuck out of him. DDP ran away. That was it. I mean, that kind of sums it all up right there. 19 years ago this week, on June 15th, 2002, Major League Wrestling hosted its first ever event called Genesis from Viking Hall, formerly the ECW Arena, in Philadelphia, featuring an 8-man single elimination tournament to crown the first ever MLW champion as they tried to recreate the infamous night Shane Douglas won and then threw down the NWA title in that very same building. And out of that, the original angle with Douglas, the Extreme Championship Wrestling title was created. That's pretty much the point, I think, in which it went from Eastern Championship Wrestling to Extreme Championship Wrestling. But this time, here with MLW, it did not get over quite the same way. And it made for a very flat finish when Shane Douglas won the title in a three-way dance against Vampiro and Tayo Kea, or Kea, I think it's Kea. Douglas spat on the MLW title, he threw it down, but referee John Finnegan and the local athletic commissioner warned him that he would be fined and suspended for life in the state of Pennsylvania if he did not take the title and defend it. After that, MLW went on hiatus for a few months, and Douglas was stripped of the championship. When MLW returned in September, they ran a show at the Manhattan Center where Satoshi Kojima beat Jerry Lynn, making Kojima, according to Kurt Bauer, the first officially recognized MLW champion. And Kojima would go on to defend the title in All Japan Pro Wrestling several times. 4 days later, NWA Total Nonstop Action presented its first show live on pay-per-view. This was back during the weekly pay-per-view era from Huntsville, Alabama. And what a debut show it was. Jeff Jarrett opened with a diatribe about how the battle royal to crown a new NWA champion was a really stupid idea. Out comes Ken Shamrock to agree with Jeff Jarrett, saying that the idea sucks. Then Scott Hall comes out from the crowd. He agrees with the both of them. Nothing like burying creative on the very first night to get the fans excited for your big main event. Also on this show, they interviewed a dude by the name of Mortimer Plumtree, who talked about the tag team that he was going to be managing called the Johnsons. Get it? They're a couple of dicks. They wore masks and flesh-colored bodysuits to the ring for their match against James Storm and Psychosis. A tag team I never knew that I needed in my life, but boy do I wish I was able to see more of them together. James Storm and Psychosis. The Battle Royal that I mentioned came down to Ken Shamrock and Malice. I think it turned into a singles match at that point. Ricky Steamboat was the special referee. Shamrock won the title with a belly-to-belly suplex. One last note on this. The first several weekly pay-per-views that TNA ran, they each featured a midget match. One of the more infamous midgets was named Puppet the Psycho Dwarf, who was known for threatening to kill the other midgets. So you see, he wasn't a midget, he was a dwarf. He wanted to murder the midgets. He also, the month after this, pulled a gun on Jeff Jarrett in the middle of the ring. And in another infamous segment, was shown masturbating into a trash can while asking Goldilocks, the interview lady, if she wanted some of his porridge. How that company has managed to survive as long as it has is still a mystery to me. One day after that, I mean, how the fuck do you follow that up? One day after that, on June 20th, 2002, with the company going through creative woes and its biggest star, Steve Austin, having just walked out, in large part because of what he called the company's piss-poor creative, Vince McMahon decides the only way to fix things is to bring former WCW World Champion Vince Russo back to join the creative team, which lasted all of 2 weeks. But yes, indeed, some people may hear this and may not even be aware of the fact that Vince Russo was brought back. He was rehired by WWE in 2002. Supposedly, Time Warner was paying for Russo's legal fees in the lawsuit that Hulk Hogan brought against him and the company, stemming from the Bash at the Beach incident in the year 2000. And one of the stipulations of them doing so was that he could not work for any other wrestling company. Which means that if that's true, that would mean that Vince McMahon would have had to get Time Warner to waive that restriction so that he could rehire Russo. So think about how awkward that must have been for Hogan when he heard the news, considering the fact that he was back working for WWE at the time. Hogan had just come back a few months earlier, and now you find out with this lawsuit still pending that you brought, that Vince Russo is being brought in to run creative. 24 hours later, Russo met with the creative team, and not even 24 hours after that, he was demoted to the role of creative consultant, basically being paid to sit at home and watch the TV shows. Now, exactly what happened, only those involved really know, but by Russo's own admission, he was not familiar with the product at the time. He did not watch the product at the time on television, and that was said to be a major strike against him. And he was also said to have pitched a new variation of the WCW invasion angle that was not met with a lot of enthusiasm. So it involved Eric Bischoff and Shane McMahon and Vince McMahon. Russo's version of events, or where the blame lies for all that happened, has shifted a bit over the years. And one thing you get from all of these interviews that Russo has given is how very highly he thinks of himself. Here's what he told Ring Rust Radio in 2015, putting the blame on Triple H for things falling apart. I was very disappointed when I almost went back to WWE in 2002 and found out more or less Triple H was not in my corner after all that I did for him. Fast forward 12 years later and you see the position that he is in and that Stephanie is in. And now it all makes sense. Makes all the sense in the world. If you eventually want the power, then you want to keep a guy away like a Vince Russo from a creative standpoint who is going to produce a better TV show, better content than you can. A Vince Russo is a better writer and went to school for writing to be a writer. Holy shit. If he went to school for writing, he must have missed the lesson on redundancy. He went to school for writing to be a writer. Really? I would have thought you went to school for writing to be a fucking circus clown. He says, when that happened in 2002 and I learned he was working behind the scenes to keep me out of the WWE, I would be lying to you if I told you my opinion of him did not change. In 2019, this is what he said on the Truth with Consequences podcast. And a hat tip to 411 Mania for the transcript here. So first of all, I can hear the bros, by the way. I can't not hear just bro in my head as I read this. So first of all, I had already laid everything out to Vince. I go into that room, bro. There it is. Bruce is not in the room. He was very upset at this time that Bruce Pritchard, I guess maybe on his podcast, was talking about the Russo stuff. Russo says Bruce wasn't even there. He never saw him. He wasn't in any of these meetings. He's very upset about that. But anyway, he says Bruce isn't in the room, so whatever information he's getting secondhand. He wasn't there. I laid out an entire year of programming for that team. They were silent. Their jaws hit the ground. They were dumbfounded, and it became pretty evident to everybody in the room, well, if Vince McMahon hires this guy, there's no need for us. I knew damn well when I left that room, those guys were going to bury me to Vince because of what I had laid out. They couldn't lay out a tenth of that on their best day. And I knew they knew, holy shit, if this guy comes in here, there's no need for us. So they go in to protect your spot mode. I knew all of this, but in the back of my mind, I'm saying, Vince, if you want to go with these guys, go with these guys. So I fly home. The whole plane ride, I'm like, this isn't going to work. I knew it wasn't going to work. Sure enough, I get home, and my wife tells me that Vince is trying to... There's so many Vinces here. My wife tells me that Vince is trying to get a hold of me. It was late in the evening at that point. I spoke to Vince in the morning, and here's where all the holes in the story... Well, there's a period there. I don't know what he was trying to say. Here's what Vince says to me. Vince, this is not going to work out. And here's what I said to Vince. Yeah, Vince. It's like a comedy routine. Let me see if I can simplify this here. Okay, so we have Vince M. And we have... We'll just say Russo and McMahon. How about that? We'll make it easy. I'll alter the words as I go along here in real time. I can multitask. Anyway, he goes, Russo, this is not going to work out. And I said to McMahon, yeah, Vince, it's not going to work out because the minute I left that room, everybody went back to you and buried me and buried my creative, which is exactly what I knew they would do. And I said to McMahon, I'm telling you right now, Vince, you do not have the talent in that room to turn your company around. This is 2002. I said, you do not have the talent in that room to turn the company around. Now, bro, what happens at that point? At that point, bro, Vince is doing his best to keep me on as a consultant. And why is Vince doing that, bro? I'll tell you why, bro. He's doing it because he knows I'm right. And he knows what I'm saying is right. Bro, I did not watch the product leading up to 2002 because the product sucked. I'm not going to sit there and watch a shitty wrestling show. Oh my God, there's irony is dead. Irony is just fucking dead. I'm not going to sit there and watch a shitty wrestling show, says Vince Russo here in this interview. The ratings were going down the toilet. Nobody cared what they were doing, so... Was I watching the product? Was I smart to the product? No. Here's where it broke down, bro. Vince McMahon hired me without telling Stephanie. And he told Stephanie after he hired me. And the reason why I knew this was not going to work out was because Stephanie was not there in person when I met with him in person in 2002. I had to go in a separate room and talk to her on a speakerphone. And off the bat, Stephanie was treating me like I was her redheaded stepchild. She did not want me there. She was not happy. It was not part of the process. When she hung up the phone, I said, this is not going to work. So now Stephanie is hot. Vince knows Stephanie is hot. Everybody in that room buries me to Vince. Vince tells me things aren't going to work out. All right, enough of this. But you can see how things have shifted. First, it was the fact that Triple H had it out for him. Then he's telling this person here that Stephanie had it out for him. Then he's saying that, no, it was the other creative members who were burying me behind my... It was everybody's fault. Anyway, that's his version of events. Russo would not be unemployed for long. A few weeks later, on July 9th, NWA TNA hired Russo in a creative capacity, even though he had secretly been helping them even before that in an unofficial capacity. In fact, he takes credit for coming up with the TNA name, which really stood for tits and ass, not for total nonstop action. How very Russo-rific. 16 years ago this week, on June 18, 2005, the Summer of Punk kicked off at Ring of Honor's Death Before Dishonor 3 show, where Punk, in what was to have been his final match in Ring of Honor before signing with WWE, ended up beating Austin Aries to win the Ring of Honor world title. And he cut a promo after the match. This is just a portion of it. It's not the entire thing. This belt in the hands of any other man is just a belt. But in my hands, it becomes power. Just like this microphone in the hands of any of the boys in the back is just a microphone. But in the hands of a dangerous man like myself, it becomes a pipe bomb. These words I speak, spoken by anybody else, are just words strung loosely together to form sentences. What I say, I mean, and what I mean, I say, and they become anthems. You see, if I could be afforded the time here for a little bit of a story. There was once an old man walking home from work. He was walking in the snow, and he stumbled upon a snake frozen in the ice. He took that snake, and he brought it home, and he took care of it. He thawed it out, and he nursed it back to health. And as soon as that snake was well enough, it bit the old man. And as the old man lay there dying, he asked the snake, why? I took care of you. I loved you. I saved your life. And that snake looked that man right in the eye and said, you stupid old man. I'm a snake. The greatest thing the devil ever did was make you people believe he didn't exist. And you're looking at him right now. I am the devil himself. And all of you stupid, mindless people fell for it. You followed me hook, line, and sinker. All of you did. And I'm not mad at you. I just feel sorry for you. This belongs to me. Everything you see here belongs to me. And I did what I had to do to get my hands on this. Now I am the greatest pro wrestler walking the earth today. This is my stage. This is my theater. You are my puppets. Ladies and gentlemen, the champ is here. You don't have to love it, but you better learn to accept it, because I'm taking this with me, and there's not a single person in that locker room that can stop me. Punk would not even hold that title a full 2 months before dropping it to Jamie Noble, but in that time, he signed his WWE contract on the ROH title belt. This, before any pipe bombs he dropped in WWE, was the first Summer of Punk. 15 years ago this week, on June 17th, 2006, I attended my very first Ring of Honor live event called In Your Face, their final show from the ballroom at the New Yorker Hotel. After this, they would upgrade to the Grand Ballroom inside the Manhattan Center, which is literally around the corner from the hotel. I can't believe it's been 15 years. Holy shit. I remember the hotel staff being very upset when fans threw rolls of toilet paper at Jimmy Rave. That was the whole, gimmick at the time. People would throw rolls of toilet paper at him. He would throw it back. But some of them, I guess, hit the chandelier above the ring. I remember some of the pieces, I don't know if the pieces got knocked off or if they broke off. I think they broke off. So now you've got pieces of chandelier being struck by these rolls of toilet paper being knocked down to the ring. So I know they weren't very happy about that. I remember one of the craziest live spots that I had ever seen, where BJ Whitmer powerbombed Jimmy Jacobs from the top rope, not into the ring, but into the crowd, onto a bunch of planted fans. But from where I was sitting, I was third row ringside on the opposite side. I didn't see the group of people that had gathered over there to catch them, and it just looked like he powerbombed him to the floor. Adam Pearce beat Claudio Castagnoli by disqualification when Chris Hero hit Pearce with the CZW title belt. Homicide then beat Chris Hero. And in the main event, a non-title three-way match where Bryan Danielson, Kenta, and Samoa Joe went to battle. This is the match where Danielson did a dive into the crowd onto Joe and almost killed me, because I had my face buried in my disposable camera. I was trying to shoot it instead of moving out of the fucking way like a normal person. Kenta hit the go to sleep on Brian for the win in what I remember being a fantastic match. I mean, with those three, how could it not be? 12 years ago this week, on the June 15th, 2009 episode of Monday Night Raw, Randy Orton won a fatal four-way match against John Cena, Triple H, and The Big Show to win the vacant WWE Championship, vacated by Batista after a bicep tear. And Vince McMahon was to announce the name of the new general manager of Raw, but instead made another major announcement that he had accepted an offer he simply could not refuse: to sell Monday Night Raw. We should all be so lucky to get an announcement like that today. And to whom did he sell Raw? Why, he sold it to his old frenemy, Donald Trump, who appeared in a pre-taped video that was so obviously pre-taped. Whenever McMahon tried to interact with him and act like it was live, it was all out of sync, and Trump just kind of just stampeded over him, and it just came off horribly. The live crowd booed the shit out of the Trump stuff from the moment his name was mentioned, because they were in Charlotte. They were in Charlotte, North Carolina. They were in Flair country. You could hear chants of "We want Flair" as Vince was teasing who the new owner was. And they had brought Flair to the show to make sure he was spotted in town to throw people off and get them thinking that it was him, but in reality it wasn't. Well, that was pretty fucking dumb. It backfired on them, and people wanted to see Flair. So when they saw Trump, they booed. Trump said that he would be there live the following week. He was making that episode of Raw commercial-free for the first time ever, which paid off because Raw the following week shot up to nearly 7 million viewers, with 5.8 million for hour one and a whopping 7.8 million for hour two, a number that they had not seen since the glory days of the Attitude Era. But the storyline was quickly aborted, in part because USA Network issued a press release after the show touting Trump as the new owner of Raw as if it were real. And a bunch of finance websites and news outlets mentioned the news as if Trump actually owned Raw, which of course is not a company, it's a fucking television show, and not even a very good one. Investors didn't like that very much. The WWE stock dropped about 7% that week. So the following Monday, with Trump promising more commercial-free episodes and promising to pay back the money to fans that they paid for their tickets, $245,000 at the gate, according to the Donald. This was the June 22nd episode now. All of that money would be paid back to the fans. Vince McMahon saw what Trump was trying to do. He was trying to bankrupt him. So, let me recap this for a moment. Donald Trump buys Raw, which is a television show, from Vince McMahon, and he declares himself the sole owner of that show for an undisclosed sum of money. They never told us what the dollar amount was. I doubt it was the $1 billion that Fox paid for SmackDown years later. So he buys this show and he calls himself the sole owner, only to intentionally sabotage the show that he just paid for. If the man is the sole owner of Raw, then what was Vince McMahon so concerned about? If Trump wants to sabotage his own show, let him. This was a very poorly thought out story. Very on brand for Monday Night Raw. Vince McMahon in storyline ended up paying double what Trump paid him just to take back control of the show. And just like that, the Trump era of Raw ended as quickly as it began. 9 years ago this week, June 20th, 2012, marked the television debut of the new NXT, the modern version, airing for the first time from Full Sail University. Jim Ross and William Regal handled the announcing while Dusty Rhodes served as the general manager. And check these matches out. Bo Dallas defeated Rick Victor. This was before he joined the Ascension. The Ascension did wrestle on this show. This was the original team of Conor O'Brien and Kenneth Cameron before Cameron was released in November of that year and replaced by Victor. This was after Cameron was arrested. And today he's in the NWA as Tom Latimer. But on this show, the Ascension defeated the team of CJ Parker, good old Juice Robinson, and Mike Dalton, years before he would eventually find success as Tyler Breeze. And in the main event, Tyson Kidd defeated Michael McGillicuddy. You can check out my thoughts on that first show on Sound Off episode 224. I don't remember what I said about that first episode of NXT, but I enjoyed those early days of NXT, especially into 2014, 2015. It just had a different vibe than it does today. It's not the same. And 5 years ago this week, on June 19th, 2016, we got the first meeting between John Cena and AJ Styles in the ring, and it was excellent. Styles picked up the win when Gallows and Anderson ran in after a ref bump and hit the Magic Killer on Cena, then pulled AJ on top for the win. Every time these two were in the ring together, here at SummerSlam, again at the Royal Rumble that they did at the Alamo Dome, it always had a big fight feel to it, and those two guys brought it. Dean Ambrose won the Money in the Bank ladder match, and Seth Rollins pinned Roman Reigns clean to win the WWE World Heavyweight Championship, only for Ambrose to cash in his Money in the Bank, much the same way Rollins did the previous year at WrestleMania. Ambrose hit Dirty Deeds and pinned Rollins to win the title. So in a matter of minutes, the WWE title went from Roman Reigns to Seth Rollins to Dean Ambrose. All three members of the Shield held the title in the same night. I don't know that that has ever happened before or since with another faction. 2 days later, we learned why Roman Reigns dropped the title and did so cleanly. WWE acknowledged the tribal chief by announcing that he had been suspended for his first violation of the company's talent wellness policy. That was a very big story at that time. People wondering what that would mean for the future of Roman Reigns. Is this going to derail his career? Look at where he is today. Look at what one heel turn did for this guy's career. How it just turned it all around. It's amazing. It's going to make him a bigger babyface when the time comes, but hopefully that won't be for a very long time yet. And that is this week in wrestling history. Drop me an email if you have any questions or comments, thesolemonster@gmail.com. Please include your name and where you are from when you write in. If you would like your letter or question to be read on the air, possibly. I hope to get back to the questions here as part of the main shows very soon. So you can email me there. Follow me on Twitter, @solemonster. Be doing some live tweeting tonight during Hell in a Cell, and then come on over to the YouTube channel. Just type in Solemonster Sounds Off. You should find the official channel. We just broke 63,000 subscribers. If you are not one of them, I do not know why. You need to do something very quickly to change that. So join me then. As soon as the pay-per-view goes off the air, we'll do the live recap, and then I have a very special, very fun announcement to make that you will want to hear as it pertains to Wrestle Rumble. I'm very excited to make this announcement tonight. Next Saturday, that is July 4th weekend, isn't it? I think it is, in fact, July 4th weekend. Next Saturday night, as soon as Dynamite goes off the air, I will be live on YouTube for a full recap. And then next Sunday, back with you on July 4th, our Day of Independence. There is no rest for the weary. I will be back next weekend for episode 710 of The Sound Off. And I hope that you will join me then for a very special holiday edition. And also that you will consider becoming a channel member. On YouTube, we have two different membership tiers. Sound Off Superstar for $4.99 a month. Sound Off Legend for $9.99. With that, you get the lost episodes, the retro audio that is going up slowly but surely. But all channel members now have access to the official Sound Off Discord server. And I hope to see you there. We're slowly building an audience there. Right now, it's reserved only for our YouTube family. So please consider becoming a member. I will be back with you later tonight. After Hell in a Cell. So until then, be well, stay safe, have yourselves a great week, and I will see you back here for 710 next weekend. Until then, take care, guys.
The Solemn Monster sounds off.
Shayna Baszler, 416 days as NXT Women's Champion, lost to a wine snob because of a possessed doll, and then went and yelled at said doll. If this is their version of a horror movie, Shayna Baszler is about to be killed off. Fire shot out of the ring post, which distracted Shayna, who was promptly rolled up and pinned. This woman gets rolled up so much, Snoop Dogg is going to start smoking her.
It's the one and only Deagle Double G.
Snoop Dogg! Snoop Dogg!
The Solemn Monster sounds off. Available wherever you hear podcasts, including iTunes, iHeartRadio, Spotify, and now Pandora.
Want more content?
Visit youtube.com/thesolemnmonster for Sound Off extras and more. And follow The Solemn Monster on Twitter, @Solemnmonster.
Solemn Monster.
Put that cigarette out.
Solemn Monster sounds off.